In your personal evolution, you're being urged toward your potential. And this unique development has a vital, yet sometimes mysterious ingredient. It's your self-confidence. Self-confidence is both a cause and a result of many factors, including your success. In this program, Brian Tracy leads you to understand how you can start where you are today in developing rock-solid self-confidence. This powerful mental ally will enable you to conquer fear and self-doubt, have better relationships, and perform better in any endeavor. You were born with a right to these and other fruits of self-confidence. And here, you'll learn methods of reclaiming title to that healthy mental and physical glow that seems to elude so many. You'll learn a number of practical action steps you can take to build immediate feelings of self-confidence. These will help you develop new habits of behavior, positive habits that will instill greater levels of the self-confidence you want and deserve. As author and narrator, Brian Tracy brings a lifetime of research and experience to this program. Through his work with Brian Tracy Learning Systems, and as author of several best-selling audio and video programs, Brian inspires men and women throughout the world. Now for you, Nightingale Conant and Brian Tracy offer a program that could be the turning point you've been looking for. The Science of Self-Confidence.
Hello, I'm Brian Tracy, and welcome to the Science of Self-Confidence. For more than 25 years, I've studied successful men and women, looking for the characteristics and qualities they have in common that have enabled them to achieve so much more than the average person. I've read thousands of books and articles and research studies, and I've come to the conclusion that the foundation quality of success in every walk of life is self-confidence. Every man or woman who has ever accomplished anything out of the ordinary has turned out to have greater self-confidence than the ordinary person. And when you develop yourself to the point where your belief in yourself is so strong that you know that you can accomplish anything you put your mind to, your future will be unlimited. A woman who had listened to one of my programs wrote to me recently and told me that one line in that program had changed her whole outlook on life. It was simply a question which asked, "What one great thing would you dare to dream if you knew you could not fail?" When she began asking herself that question over and over, her entire view of what was possible for her in life expanded dramatically. She saw clearly what she really wanted to be and have and do, and she simultaneously realized that it was only fear and doubt in her own abilities that was holding her back. What would you do differently if you were absolutely assured of success in any undertaking? What if some great force could endow you with the power to achieve any goal that you set for yourself? Or, to put it another way, what if you were completely unafraid of anyone or anything, and you felt completely free to act in any area in your own best interests? The fact is that if you develop the quality of unshakable self-confidence, your whole world would be different. With greater confidence in yourself and your abilities, you would set bigger goals and make bigger plans and commit yourself to achieving objectives that today you only dream about. You would take whatever steps were necessary to earn more money and enjoy a higher standard of living. You'd set your sights on a bigger house, a better car, more beautiful clothes, and nicer vacations, and all kinds of things for your family and for those close to you. You would do what you really want to do, and you'd refuse to conform to the wishes or opinions of anyone else. You'd define your life in your own terms and live every day consistent with exactly what it is you want and no one else. With greater self-confidence, you'd be different in every part of your work life and career. You might decide to ask for a promotion or a raise or even change to another job or another company or even another industry. If you're in sales, you would see more people and make better and more forceful presentations and ask for more orders and close more business. If you're in management, you would organize and reorganize your human and material resources to create a work environment that suited you perfectly, rather than making endless compromises in an attempt to please a variety of different people. With greater self-confidence, you'd be bolder and more imaginative. You'd be more creative and willing to experiment with new and different ideas and ways of doing things. You'd be willing to consider unusual and risky alternatives and be willing to commit yourself wholeheartedly to projects that are today sitting only on the back burner of your mind. If you had unlimited self-confidence, you'd be more powerful and persuasive with other people. You'd be more popular and likable and welcome wherever you go. You would speak up and speak out clearly in your interactions with others, and you'd be admired and respected and sought after by everyone who knew you. Recognition and responsibilities would flow to you because of people's belief in your ability to do whatever it took to get the job done. Positions of prestige and status would open up for you, and people would bring you opportunities and possibilities that you cannot now even imagine. With greater self-confidence, you could deal more effectively with the inevitable problems and difficulties that arise in day-to-day life. You'd think continually in terms of solutions and how you could turn any situation to your best advantage. You would laugh at adversities that would dishearten most people, and you'd be able to pluck success out of the jaws of failure. You would turn lemons into lemonade. You would feel invincible and unconquerable. With higher levels of self-confidence, you'd be far more effective in dealing with difficult people and situations. You'd be a far better negotiator, and you'd be able to ask for and get better prices, better terms, better conditions in everything that you bought and sold. With greater self-confidence, with an unshakable belief in yourself, nothing would be impossible for you. More than anything else, you would feel terrific about yourself. You would feel truly happy about every part of your life, knowing deep down inside that you have the ability to take whatever steps and make whatever changes are necessary to assure that your life is exactly the way you want it. You'd experience a tremendous sense of control, which is the fundamental condition for happiness, well-being, and maximum performance. You would feel like the master of your fate and the captain of your soul. You'd feel completely self-determined and in charge of your life. You'd experience a feeling of strength and power and purpose and a positive mental attitude toward yourself and everyone in your life and everything you do. With unshakable self-confidence, you would unquestionably be an exceptional human being. In psychology, there's a principle or a law of becoming that simply says that each person is in a continual process of becoming or evolving and growing in the direction of his or her dominant thoughts. Your body is also in a state of becoming. At a normal rate of cell death and replenishment, you end up with a brand new body every 7 years. And while your physical evolution in becoming is affected by the food that you put into your body, your mental evolution and becoming is largely determined by the thoughts that you put into your mind. Anything that you think about long enough and hard enough eventually becomes a part of your mental processes, exerting its force on your attitudes and on your behavior. The law of concentration says that anything you dwell upon grows in your reality. The more you dwell on the person you would like to be, with the qualities you would like to have, the more these thoughts are implanted deeply into your subconscious mind and become part of your ongoing evolution. In this sense, you are a self-made man or woman. You are where you are and what you are because of the thoughts that you have allowed to preoccupy your mind. Whatever you've dwelled upon over the months and years, you have become, and you are, right now, today. Not only have you made yourself into what you are, but you are continuing with the job of construction with every thought you think. Since this is an unavoidable fact of life, the smartest thing that a person can do is to persistently think the thoughts that are consistent with the kind of person he or she would like to be. One of the most profound discoveries in all of human history is that thought is creative. Thoughts held in mind produce after their kind. Like begets like. Your thoughts become your realities. You do become what you think about most of the time. You cannot harbor one kind of thought and experience a different kind of existence. The development of unshakable self-confidence therefore begins with you taking full, complete, systematic, and purposeful control of the contents of your conscious mind, disciplining yourself to think consistently of only the things that you desire and to keep your mind off of the things that you fear. All of life is from the inside out. The law of correspondence, considered one of the most important of all the mental laws, simply says that your outer world will be a mirror image reflection of your inner world. What you see on the outside is merely a reflection of what is going on the inside. The fact is that with almost no exceptions, everything that a person experiences in their outer life corresponds exactly to something that's going on in their inner life. True happiness and success comes from living your life in harmony with the laws that govern your being. Even though these laws are invisible, they're like the law of gravity, also invisible, but to be violated only at your peril. Happy people are simply those who obey the laws and follow the laws and live their lives consistent with the laws. If we want to have self-confidence on the outside, we must have complete integrity on the inside. The real foundation of self-confidence is living your life consistent with your innermost values and principles while thinking and acting in harmony with your highest aspirations. Men and women with the most rock-solid self-confidence are inevitably those who are absolutely clear about what it is they believe to be right and good and worthwhile, and they live their lives consistent with these values. Everything that they do or say is a reflection of these innermost convictions. Your whole world can fall down around you, but as long as you know that you're doing the right thing, you'll have a deep inner sense of calm that will manifest itself in an attitude of confidence and self-assurance in any situation. You'll have many ups and downs in life, but what is most important is that you remain true to yourself. And then, as Shakespeare said, thou canst not then be false to any man. So the starting point of developing high levels of self-confidence and, in reality, becoming a superior human being is to think through and to decide upon your values. Recently, I addressed about 150 members of a national sales force of a very successful company. All the people at the meeting were positive and upbeat, and they had a special quality of goodness about them. When I commented on this, the president of the company showed me the value statement that the executives of the company had worked out before they had begun operations. There were two pages of values and principles, which were given to everyone in the company when they began. These two pages had been subsequently reduced onto plasticized cards that each person could carry in their wallet or purse. The president told me an interesting story. He said that whenever two or more people in the company were wrestling with a decision of any kind, even over the telephone, they would pull out their plasticized cards containing the definitions of their values, and they would go through the values together, one by one, and compare the various options with each value. Whatever decision they finally made would always stand the value test without question. In a recent study covering 25 years of business history, the researchers found that companies that had very clear written values to which everyone in the company ascribed had earned an average of 700% greater profit over the 25 years than other companies in the same industries that did not have written codes of values. The economic and personal results of individuals and corporations with clear values always tend to be far superior to those of companies and individuals whose values are vague or unclear. Your starting point toward higher self-confidence and personal greatness is to clarify your values for yourself, to decide for yourself what it is that you believe in. What do you stand for, and even more, what will you not stand for? What would you pay for or sweat for or maybe even die for? Do you value your family, your God, your health, your work or career? Or do you value principles such as freedom and liberty, compassion for the less fortunate, or reverence for life? Do you believe in honesty and truth and sincerity and hard work and success? Whatever your values are, think them through and write them down. A useful exercise you can engage in is to think of the men and women, living and dead, whom you most admire. What qualities or attributes of these people do you consider to be the most important? What qualities do you look for in your friends and associates when you're trying to decide whether or not to become deeply involved with them? What do you think are the fundamental qualities or values that underlie business and personal relationships? What are your values? Almost everyone will select the value of integrity as one of their foremost principles. Actually, integrity is more than a value. It is the one quality of mind that assures or guarantees all the other values that you select. Whenever I conduct a strategic planning session for a corporation, the executives of the corporation always select integrity as their highest value and the most important organizing principle for the entire organization. And the word integrity, according to the dictionary, means perfect, undivided, complete, unified, a single whole, without blemish or fault. It's a fine value to choose. However, you cannot have a little bit of integrity. You cannot have a value when it's convenient and put it aside when it's not convenient. The act of selecting your values is also the act of clearly stating to yourself, and sometimes to others, exactly how you will live from this moment forward. Once you've selected a value and you have declared it to be one of your unifying principles, you are in effect saying that this is something upon which you will never compromise. And your level of adherence to the values you have personally selected is the real measure of your quality as a human being. Unshakable self-confidence comes from unshakable commitment to your values. When deep down inside yourself you know that you will never violate your highest principles, you experience a deep sense of personal power that enables you to deal openly and honestly and with complete self-confidence in almost every human situation. By the way, if you're having trouble clarifying your values, a very helpful exercise is to take some time to write out your own obituary or eulogy. This obituary is your vision of the kind of person you wish to be and the kind of values you wish to live by. No one is perfect, and we all have a long way to go in living our lives consistent with our highest values. But the very exercise of writing out your ultimate goal in terms of your personal evolution will exert a powerful influence on everything you do thereafter. Both consciously and unconsciously, you'll always be drawn toward living and acting more and more like the person you described in that final testament. The development of unshakable self-confidence will open up such possibilities for you as you cannot now imagine. You'll be able to dream bigger dreams, set bigger goals, make greater commitments, and plunge into life more wholeheartedly than you ever have before. Self-confidence is the hinge upon which turns the gate of individual achievement. When your self-confidence becomes unlimited, you will be able to realize more of your potential than you could under any other circumstances. More than 2,000 years ago, Aristotle wrote that happiness is a condition. It's not something that is achieved by pursuing it directly, but rather comes as a result of our engaging in purposeful activities. In a way, this is a statement of the law of indirect effort. This law simply says that almost everything we get in life involving emotional experiences comes to us more indirectly rather than directly. It comes to us as a result of doing something else. If we pursue happiness directly, it eludes us. But if we get busy doing something that's really important to us and begin to make real progress in the direction of our dreams and aspirations, we find ourselves feeling very happy indeed. Self-confidence is also subject to the law of indirect effort. We achieve higher levels of self-confidence by setting and achieving ever higher goals and objectives. As we move forward, step by step, as we feel ourselves advancing in life, we feel better and stronger and more capable of taking on even bigger challenges. We develop the confidence to tackle larger goals by applying our energies to the accomplishment of smaller goals. We build up our confidence as we go until we reach the point where there is nothing that we won't take on. In fact, the habit of setting and achieving ever larger goals is absolutely indispensable to the development of ever higher levels of strength and personal power. You can only really believe in yourself when you absolutely know that you have the ability to do what you set out to do. True self-confidence comes not from positive wishing or positive hoping or positive thinking. It comes from positive knowing, based on having proven to yourself over and over again that you have what it takes to get from wherever you are to wherever you want to go. Self-confidence is really a state of mind. It's an attitude. And as an attitude, it's more important than facts. But it must be based on facts to be the kind of self-confidence that you can rely upon in a crunch. Your job is to take the practical steps to convince yourself objectively that you are absolutely unstoppable and that you can achieve anything that you put your mind to. If self-confidence is an attitude of mind, it's based on mental principles and mental laws, foremost among which is thought is creative. You are not what you think you are, but what you think you are. As you systematically and deliberately change your thinking about yourself, your outer reality changes to conform with it. Your thoughts create your life, including and especially your thoughts with regard to your level of self-confidence. The reason why goals are so important is because of these mental laws. You are happy and successful to the degree to which you conform your life and your thinking to these laws and live in harmony with them. The first law, which we've already discussed, is the law of cause and effect. It's so simple and so powerful that you need to remind yourself of it all the time. Another way of stating this law is the principle of sowing and reaping. It simply says that whatsoever a man soweth, that also shall he reap. If you sow clear goals and objectives in your mind, you will reap clear results and rewards in your outer life. A subset of the law of cause and effect is the law of attraction. This is considered to be one of the most important of all laws in explaining what happens to you. It simply says that like attracts like. It says that you inevitably attract into your life the people, ideas, circumstances, and opportunities that are in harmony with your dominant thoughts. Whatever you're thinking, most of the time, you're drawing into your life from all directions. This is why fuzzy goals bring fuzzy results, whereas clear goals bring clear results. And since your level of self-confidence is directly tied to how effective you feel you are in achieving your goals, it's very important that you know exactly what it is you want and that you think of nothing else. Another law, again a variation of the law of cause and effect, is the law of correspondence. The law of correspondence, as we mentioned before, says that your outer world tends to be a mirror of your inner world. Your outer world of health, wealth, and relationships will be a mirror image reflection of your thinking on each of these subjects. Your thought is the most powerful force in your universe. It is both creative and causative. Every minute of every day, it's forming the world around you. As Shakespeare said, "Nothing is, but thinking makes it so." Your life is what your thoughts make it. Another principle I mentioned earlier is the law of concentration. This is another terribly important law when it comes to the development and maintenance of your self-confidence. The law of concentration says that whatever you dwell upon continually grows into your reality. Thinking about a subject, dwelling on it continually, is like watering and fertilizing a seed. It causes it to grow faster in your experience. The more you dwell on any goal or subject, the more of your mental capacities are dedicated to making that goal or subject a reality. The law of concentration explains why unwavering dedication to a single purpose goes hand in hand with all great accomplishment. The ability to concentrate without diversion on a single subject to the exclusion of all others explains why ordinary people achieve extraordinary things. Because of this mental law, an average individual with average capabilities, by bringing all of his or her mental powers to bear on the achievement of a single goal, can often accomplish far more than a seemingly more fortunate person whose energies are dispersed by having several goals at once, or as quite commonly happens, by having no goals at all. In addition, there's the law of substitution. This law simply says that your conscious mind can only hold one thought at a time, positive or negative. And whatever thought is held continuously in your conscious mind will eventually be accepted by your subconscious mind, and your subconscious mind, in conjunction with these other mental laws, will go to work to bring that thought or idea into reality. Your subconscious mind is inordinately powerful and is the seat of all your emotions, your beliefs, your values, your attitudes, and your feelings. The development of the unshakable self-confidence that you desire requires that you step up to your mental computer and take every step possible to program self-confidence deep into your subconscious mind. The final law you need to know in dealing with purpose, personal power, and self-confidence is the law of emotion. This law simply states that every decision that you make, every thought you think, every action you take is based on an emotion of some kind, either the emotion of fear at one end of the spectrum or the emotion of desire at the other end of the spectrum. When you hold a thought in your conscious mind and it's charged with an emotion of any kind, it's rapidly accepted by the subconscious. The subconscious then activates all the other mental laws and begins to turn that inner thought into an outer reality in your experience. The more powerful the emotion, the more rapid the change in your behavior and the change in your experience. And if the emotion is strong enough, the change can be instantaneous. For example, I had a friend who smoked for 30 years. He claimed that he couldn't quit smoking because it was a deeply entrenched habit going back to early adulthood. One day he had some chest pains and went to his doctor, who performed a series of tests on him. When the results of the tests were in, he sat my friend down and told him that he had a heart problem, and that if he continued to smoke, he would die within 6 months. Samuel Johnson once said, "When a man is to be hanged on the morrow, it clears his mind wondrously." Well, the idea of dying was so emotionally charged to my friend that he took out his cigarettes, threw them in the wastebasket, and never touched one again. In a positive vein, if you are absolutely convinced that you were meant to be a great success in life and that there's nothing in the world that could stop you from achieving great things as long as you persisted and threw yourself wholeheartedly into every activity, you would become an irresistible force of nature. The depth of your belief and the strength of your conviction would determine the power of your personality. If you really believe in your ability to succeed, you would become unstoppable. And you can develop this kind of belief, this inner confidence, by developing what I call the four C's. The first C stands for clarity, knowing exactly what it is you want to accomplish and exactly the person you wish to become. The second C is conviction, which is absolutely believing that you have the ability to do anything that you can put your mind to. The third C is commitment, which requires the willingness to make whatever efforts are necessary. And the fourth C is consistency, which refers to the strength of character to say and do certain things in a certain way every single day until you achieve the goals that you've set for yourself. With clarity, conviction, commitment, and consistency, you're on your way to developing the kind of confidence that will make everything possible for you. The reason goals are so important in the development of self-confidence is because the very act of setting a major goal for your life will activate all the mental laws we just talked about in your favor. It will be as though all the switches were flipped and the afterburners of your potential were turned on. Clear goals free you from the law of accident, the tendency for things to happen in a random and unpredictable way. Goals will give you a clear sense of direction and the knowledge that your life is self-determined. Goals give you a sense of power and purpose and channeled energy and a feeling that everything that happens to you is part of an organized plan that is taking you step by step toward the attainment of your highest ideals. I believe that your ability to set goals and to make plans for their accomplishment is really the master skill of success, without which very little is possible. The regular habit of goal setting and goal achieving is probably more important than anything else you could ever learn, and there are many studies that verify this. I've personally seen thousands of examples among my students of the amazing powers of goal setting. For example, recently I addressed about 600 members of a national association at their annual convention in Phoenix, Arizona. And during this talk, I emphasized the importance of them writing down exactly what it is they wanted and then making written plans to accomplish it. That was on a Thursday. About 8 days later, on the following Friday, someone called my office to get my fax number. He said he wanted to send something immediately and didn't want to wait for the mail. The letter that came in over the fax told this amazing story. The gentleman who wrote said that he'd heard about goal setting many times and that he was prepared to be unimpressed with the talk that I gave at the convention. However, exactly the opposite happened. He decided instead to sit down after the convention and seriously write out his goals for the future. The letter went on to say that on Sunday he made out a list of 10 goals, both personal and financial, that he wanted to accomplish over the next 12 months. What astonished him was that he had accomplished 5 of the 10 goals by Monday, the next day, at 5 o'clock. He could hardly believe it. He quickly wrote down 5 more goals to bring his list for the year back up to 10, and by Friday, when he wrote this letter, he had accomplished 5 more. He felt that he had made more progress in a week with clear written goals and plans than he had made in the previous year. A woman who was going through a difficult period of her life with both personal health and financial problems decided to sit down and set some new goals and make some plans to resolve her difficulties. As a result, within 1 year, she got out of a bad relationship, joined Alcoholics Anonymous and quit drinking, lost 40 pounds, and tripled her income to more than $100,000 a year. There are countless other testimonies to the power of written goals, and before this session is over, I will give you a simple goal-setting technique that can put your life into overdrive. Remember when I said that everything you do is a result of either fear or desire, the law of emotion? Fear is the great enemy of self-confidence. Fear is and has always been the greatest enemy of mankind. It is fear that holds us back more than any other factor. It goes to work on us subconsciously to undermine and sabotage our very best intentions. In fact, as you listen to this message, you're probably resolving to take some time to write out your goals and be very clear about your future. But what will happen in most cases is that fear will rear its ugly head and trip you up. Sometimes this fear will appear consciously in the form of rationalizations and excuses. Sometimes you'll find yourself saying that, "I already know what my goals are. I don't need to write them down." This is just another way of saying that you don't really believe in your ability to do any better than you're doing now. Sometimes fear will manifest itself in the form of procrastination and delay. You'll resolve to write out your goals and plans on the weekend, or on your vacation, or during the summertime, or when you can dedicate a few hours to it, sometime in the indefinite future. Then, like 97% or more of Americans, you'll never do it. And then you'll have a tendency to rationalize and to say to yourself, "Well, considering my situation, it probably wouldn't have made any difference anyway." If the great enemy of self-confidence is fear, then the great enemy of human achievement is the comfort zone. Psychologists have found that each of us has a tendency to get into a zone of performance and behavior where we're comfortable, where it's easy and unchallenging, and then to stay there. We stop striving, we relax, and day by day we develop the habits that lead to underachievement and eventual failure. The tragedy of the comfort zone is that it first of all starts off by being comfortable, but it leads rapidly to complacency. Complacency eventually leads to boredom and to the question, "Is this all there is?" Instead of life being an exciting adventure, it's merely a boring repetition for most people. And eventually, the comfort zone leads through complacency and boredom to frustration and unhappiness. Deep down inside, the average person knows that he or she is put on this earth with amazing capabilities. He or she knows that there is something better than this. As Carl Rogers, the psychologist, once said, "There is within every organism an inborn drive toward the complete fulfillment of its inherent possibilities." There is a nagging something inside that tells each person that there is far more that he or she could be and have and do. Great men and women are those who absolutely believe that they are put on earth to do something wonderful with their lives. They have a vision of something greater or better than their current circumstances. Personal greatness means having a sense of destiny and a conviction that your thoughts and your imagination are the only real limits to your possibilities. In a 5-year study of leaders, Warren Bennis discovered that each of them consciously avoided the comfort zone by continuously setting higher goals. They never allowed themselves to become complacent. They lived their lives fully extended, always striving to be more. To develop unshakable self-confidence, you need to see yourself and think of yourself as a leader, and to do what leaders do. you need to stretch yourself toward the outermost boundaries of your potentials. You need to set goals that draw out of you the very best that is in you. You need to work toward objectives that cause you to feel a sense of mastery and peak performance. And it all begins with a pad of paper, a pen, and you. Once you have your major and minor goals, you construct your plans by making detailed lists of everything that you'll have to do to achieve each goal, and then organizing the list by time and priority. What will you do first, and what will you do second? What is more important to the goal, and what is less important? Make each activity measurable and put a deadline on it. Select the very first thing that comes to your mind to do, and just get started. By setting goals, making plans, and getting started, you have joined the top 3% of Americans, and your future is virtually guaranteed. A final point with regard to goals is this. Keep your goals confidential. Many people make the mistake of talking too much about their goals. Too much talking causes their energies to dissipate and their motivation to actually decline. They lose the force and the power they would have had if they'd kept their goals to themselves and instead concentrated on purposeful activities. And now let me give you the simple technique that's transformed my life and the life of almost every person who's ever used it. It's simply this. Get yourself a spiral notebook, the kind used in school for taking notes. Then begin each day by sitting down with this notebook and writing out your main goals in the present tense as though they already were a reality. Use strong, definite words like I earn, I achieve, I am, I can. You can write other things in this notebook if you like, but the most important thing is that you take 3 to 5 minutes or more each day to write and rewrite your major goals in the present tense. Each time you write out your goals, you drive them deeper into your subconscious mind. You increase the intensity of your desire and the depth of your belief. You activate the mental laws of concentration and attraction and correspondence. You focus your mental powers and increase your confidence that the goal is achievable. By rewriting your goals every day, they become clearer and stronger, and they begin to take on a power of their own. This exercise will impress your goals so deeply into your subconscious mind that they will eventually lock on, and you will begin to move irresistibly and unstoppably toward their achievement. Your future will be guaranteed. As you develop this ability to set and achieve whatever it is you want in life, you will develop the kind of confidence that comes from positive knowing rather than positive thinking. You will become unstoppable. You have the ability to achieve peak performance in your life and in your chosen field. You have the capacity to function in the exceptional range and to achieve mastery in any area that's important to you. And the development of true self-confidence requires nothing less. In the world of test pilots and prototype aircraft, as described in the book and the movie The Right Stuff by Tom Wolfe, there is what is called the envelope. This envelope consists of an upper and a lower edge. The upper edge marks the height and speed that any previous aircraft or jet has flown up to the time of the most current test run. The upper edge of the envelope is the maximum height and speed possible for a new aircraft before it comes apart in the air or malfunctions or even self-destructs. The job of the test pilot is to expand the edge of the envelope. The job of the test pilot is to fly ever faster and higher in order to discover the outer limits of speed, height, and tolerance that a particular aircraft is capable of. The pilot takes the aircraft higher and faster continually until the plane has reached its absolute outer limits. This is called the outer edge of the envelope, and it then becomes the lower edge of the envelope for the next aircraft and the next round of testing. Every aircraft, no matter how well made, has an outer limit on its capabilities. it can go just so fast and so high, and no faster and no higher. Nothing can be done to expand the mechanical ability of something that's made of metal by the hands of man. The major difference between you and an aircraft is that there's no outer edge to your envelope. As Emerson said, the power which resides in man is new in nature, and none but he knows what that is which he can do, nor does he know until he has tried. And Thomas Edison said, if we all did the things we are capable of doing, we would literally astound ourselves. Maxwell Maltz, the author of Psycho-Cybernetics, said, within you right now is the power to do things you never dreamed possible, and this power becomes available to you just as soon as you can change your beliefs. In other words, the outer limit of your envelope or the outer limit of your potential is not fixed in time or space as that of an aircraft. It is determined solely by your own belief and by your own confidence in what you think is possible. Once you have accurately chosen your ideal job or occupation, it will change progressively over life as you evolve and mature. Your biggest responsibility is to make the decision to become very good, to become excellent at what you do. We've said that self-confidence comes from positive knowing rather than positive thinking. And it is only when you know that you are outstanding in your chosen field that you really feel terrific about yourself and that you enjoy high levels of self-confidence. Men and women who are good at what they do and who know that they're good at what they do are very different from those who are only average. They walk and talk and dress and behave differently. They have an attitude of assurance and certainty about them which enables them to stand out in any group. They have a deep-down sense of self-worth and self-confidence that is evident to everyone around them. I remember a man in his mid-20s who came up to me at a seminar in Pittsburgh recently. He said that he had started in sales just over 4 years ago. He told me that in his first year in a very competitive market, he made $22,000. But as he read and listened to tapes and attended seminars, he got better and better, and in his second year, he made $48,000. He became totally committed to ongoing professional development, and in his third year, he made $94,000. In his fourth year, he had earned just over $175,000, selling the same products in the same competitive market to the same customers at the same prices and under the same economic conditions, and he had driven to the seminar in his new Mercedes. Now, not everyone can experience such extraordinary financial results, but the most important thing about this young salesman was that he exuded self-confidence and personal pride from every pore. He had a positive self-image and high self-esteem. He was admired and respected by the people around him, and he was held up as a role model to others of what they might become if they just worked on themselves and on their jobs hard enough. This brings us to a very important mental principle called the law of accumulation. The application of this law is a fundamental reason for success in every field, including yours. This law simply says that every great life or great career is an accumulation of hundreds and perhaps thousands of efforts that nobody ever sees or appreciates. Great success is the result of countless hours, maybe even months and years, of preparation and hard work toward the goal of becoming very good at what you're doing. This law of accumulation says that life is very much like a balance sheet with both credits and debits. Every time you do something positive to enhance your abilities and to improve your life, you get a credit on the credit side of the ledger. Every time you waste your time or neglect to take advantage of an opportunity to learn and grow, you get a debit on the debit side of the ledger. And here's the key. Everything counts. Everything that you do or fail to do is written down and totaled up on your balance sheet. A successful, happy, self-confident person is simply an individual who has consciously and deliberately built up a lot of credits on his or her personal balance sheet. An unhappy, negative, or insecure person is simply a person who has a lot of debits on his or her balance sheet. And since the only things that count are your actions, it seems that every positive and constructive action you engage in adds up and increases your levels of self-confidence and self-esteem. Perhaps the most important corollary of the law of accumulation is what is called the law of incremental improvement. This law simply states that a person becomes good at his or her chosen field by improving incrementally, continuously, over a long period of time. In a study on the subject of mastery reported on in the magazine Psychology Today, the researchers concluded that mastery consisted of the ability to recognize a great variety of patterns in a given situation based on what they called a high level of integrative complexity. What this basically means is that, for example, a salesperson achieves a high level of confidence and capability in a sales situation by having both studied his or her profession and by having been in countless previous sales situations. He or she had developed the ability to integrate their knowledge and experience and to recognize a particular pattern in the sales situation based on previous experiences. Their conclusion was that it takes several thousand hours of research and practice to achieve and perform at exceptional levels in any complex field or in any difficult occupation or profession. Although there are prodigies and people who succeed in a short period of time, these are very rare. It takes several years on average for a person to become excellent in his or her chosen field. Most people achieve great financial success after the age of 40 or 50. It takes them that long to develop an extensive enough repertoire of patterns so that they can be of great value to themselves and others. The law of incremental improvement is your key to an unlimited future of prosperity, success, and self-confidence. It doesn't matter where you're starting from. All that matters is where you're going. As Theodore Roosevelt said, "Do what you can with what you have right where you are." By applying the law of incremental improvement to yourself and your work, you can begin moving upward toward joining the great ones in your field. If you're doing what you love to do, and you're doing it with all your heart, by engaging in continuous personal and professional improvement, you can begin to move forward at such a rapid rate that it will astonish you. Your goal is to be the best. Your goal is to be recognized by those around you as outstanding in your field. Your goal must be to pay any price, overcome any obstacle, and make any effort necessary to become excellent in your chosen career. The first mental fitness technique is that of positive self-talk, or the use of positive affirmations. The way you talk to yourself has an inordinate impact on your thinking and feeling. Many researchers, including Dr. Martin Seligman of the University of Pennsylvania, have discovered that high-performing men and women talk to themselves differently from low-performing men and women. Basically, your self-talk or your inner dialogue determines the tone of your emotional life. You are happy or sad, positive or negative, depending upon what you say to yourself and how you interpret events to yourself as you go along. For example, if you're cut off in traffic and you immediately become angry and begin thinking how stupid and irresponsible and what a bad driver the other person is, you will have a very different reaction than if, when you're cut off in traffic, you excuse the other person by thinking to yourself that he or she must be late or distracted or must not have seen you. It's exactly the same external event, but your conversation with yourself will determine whether or not you experience positive or negative emotions about the situation. So the starting point of using positive self-talk is to interpret everything that happens to you in a favorable way. Become what W. Clement Stone called an inverse paranoid. Imagine that the whole world is in a giant conspiracy to help you to be successful and happy. Just as a paranoid is convinced that there's a conspiracy against him or her, an inverse paranoid is convinced that there is a conspiracy for him or her. Practice the wonderful mental quality of serendipity. In the fairy tale, the three princes of Serendip traveled around finding that every apparently negative or calamitous event turned out to be positive and beneficial in the end. So make it a fun game to look for the good in every person and every situation. In Napoleon Hill's famous book, Think and Grow Rich, He says that one of the characteristics of the most successful men and women in America is that they always look for the opportunity or benefit within every setback or obstacle. And because of the law of substitution, if you're looking into every difficult situation for the lesson you can learn or for the possible opportunity it might contain, your mind tends to remain positive and you continue to function at your very best. Whenever you think of a person or event, talk to yourself in positive language. The most powerful of all affirmations for building self-confidence, for example, is for you to repeat over and over 50 or 100 times a day the words, "I can do it. I can do it. I can do it." These simple words are the verbal antidote to the fear of failure, which, as you know, is the great destroyer of self-confidence and probably the primary reason for failure in adult life. But you can diminish the fear of failure in any situation by repeating, "I can do it. I can do it. I can do it." The most powerful affirmation for building self-esteem is probably the words, "I like myself." These simple words, repeated often enough with energy and enthusiasm, are eventually accepted by your subconscious mind. As your subconscious mind accepts this message of self-liking, your self-esteem goes up and your ability to perform and your levels of effectiveness improve in every area of your life. If you want to do your work better, just say, "I love my job." In their best-selling book, Success Through a Positive Mental Attitude, W. Clement Stone and Napoleon Hill recommend that you repeat many times a day the words, "I feel happy, I feel healthy, I feel terrific." One of my favorite affirmations whenever I'm worried about anything is to cancel the worry by saying, "I believe in the perfect outcome of every situation in my life." You'll find that it's impossible to worry and fret about anything while you're repeating this kind of positive message to yourself. Your potential is unlimited using affirmations. By repeated affirmations, you can install powerful, positive commands that will eventually determine your automatic thoughts, feelings, and responses. Now, in order for affirmations to work, they must be phrased using the three P's. They must be in the present tense, they must be positive, and they must be personal. The affirmations, "I can do it," "I like myself," "I feel terrific," are all positive, present tense, and personal. The subconscious is very literal in nature and can only accept commands phrased in the present tense. For some reason, the subconscious ignores negative commands and focuses only on the positive message. You can create affirmations for each of your goals, and by repeating them continually, you drive them deep into your subconscious mind until you find yourself automatically motivated in the direction of achieving them. The fourth mental fitness technique, and another way to build your self-confidence, is to continually feed your mind with books, magazines, and audio tapes loaded with positive and uplifting messages. Just as you become what you eat, you do become what you think about. Everything that you allow into your conscious mind, positive or negative, is either raising or lowering your self-esteem and self-confidence. You can make more progress faster in a shorter period of time by learning how to get along well with the other important people in your life than you could under any other circumstances or with any other skill. Charles Schwab, the founder of U.S. Steel, said, "I will pay more for the ability to get along with other people than for any other skill in America." Fully 85% of your success in life will depend upon the quality and quantity of your relationships. In every society and in every organization, the person who knows the greatest number of people and is known to them in a favorable way is almost always the person with the greatest power and influence. Dr. Abraham Maslow, in his famous Hierarchy of Needs, suggested that the need for affiliation, to be liked and accepted and get along with a work or social group, is absolutely indispensable to your mental health. Maslow demonstrated that this need to be effective with other people is a psychological drive or hunger that must be satisfied before we can feel free to pursue the satisfaction of higher needs, such as self-esteem and self-fulfillment. Most of us learn relationship skills as we grow up, and we take them largely for granted. These skills, however, are indispensable to your self-confidence and to everything you achieve in life. They satisfy your ego needs and your social needs, and they're closely linked with physical well-being and longevity. For example, according to the experts, people with weak social ties are 3 times more likely to die prematurely than people with strong social ties. Divorced men die from heart disease, cancer, and strokes at double the rate of married men. The rate of all types of cancer is as much as 5 times higher for divorced men and women compared to their married counterparts. Your ability to send and receive, to communicate and interact happily with the important people in your life, is a key determinant of your sense of self-efficacy and your feeling of self-confidence. People with the highest levels of self-confidence are those who feel themselves capable of dealing successfully with almost any human situation. People who tend to feel uncertain and insecure with new people and new interpersonal situations invariably have low levels of self-confidence. For you to feel terrific about yourself, you have to feel terrific about your relationships. You have to feel confident and capable and effective when you think of your friends, your family, your coworkers, and situations involving other people. Fortunately, this is another example of a cause and effect relationship, and you can learn the attitudes and the behaviors you need to be popular and well-liked wherever you go. The law of indirect effort explains relationships very well. It says that you get things with people much more rapidly through indirect means rather than through direct means. In fact, when you become a relationship expert, it will be because you are no longer thinking about yourself at all. It's when you are perfectly natural and you let your personality shine through without attempting to shade it or change it in any way that you perform at your best. You are more relaxed, more spontaneous, more humorous, and more enjoyable to be with. To start with, remember always that in human relationships, it's not what you do, but who you are that counts. You can never be more or less or different from the person you really are. Most people who have problems with others are trying to be something that they're not, or even worse, they're trying to be something that they think will please the other person. As Francis Bacon said, "This maketh a man who can in no way be true to his own ends." When you practice the law of concentration and dwell upon your values and goals, and upon the kind of person you want to be, these thoughts soak deep into your subconscious mind and cause you to act in a manner consistent with them. The law of correspondence says that your outer world is merely a reflection of your inner world. Your job is to continue to work on your inner world and let the outer world take care of itself. Whenever you have a problem or difficulty with another person, a good exercise is to turn within and ask yourself, what is it in me that's causing this other person to behave this way? For example, if you have a problem with your child or one of your employees or friends, always turn within and accept responsibility for triggering the other person's behavior, whatever it is. It may turn out that the way the other person is acting has nothing to do with you, but by holding yourself accountable instead of blaming or looking outside yourself for the reason, you take full control of your own mind and you keep yourself calm and focused. Your self-esteem, how much you really like yourself, will determine how much you like others and how well you get along with them. The more you like yourself, the more you like others, and the more they like you. One of the most important principles in understanding how power and influence work in our society is called the law of reciprocity. This law is based on the age-old discovery that whenever you do something for another person, he or she feels a sense of obligation to you and can only remove that sense of obligation by doing something of an equal or greater value for you. It also happens that if you do something to another person, he or she will also have a desire to reciprocate in kind. The law of reciprocity explains why many people make more progress in 5 years than the average person may make in 20 years of equally hard work in the same industry and sometimes in the same company. The reason is that smart people seek out every opportunity to do things for other people in advance. Over time, they build up a reservoir of goodwill and favors that cause people to want to help them get ahead. It's another example of sowing and reaping, cause and effect. It's a fact of life that the more of yourself that you give away to others with no direct expectation of return, the more you'll receive back, sometimes from the most unexpected sources. The winner in life is the person who is always looking for opportunities to give. The loser is the one who is always insisting upon getting before they give anything. When you're younger, you usually have far more time than money, so you give of your time. As you become older and more financially secure, you have less time but more money, so you give financially. But always the rule is to give whenever and wherever you possibly can, knowing that it will eventually come back to you as an abundant harvest. In your relationships, the same rule holds true. In every relationship, you want to make the other person feel glad that he or she spoke to you. And you do this by making other people feel important. One wonderful result of this principle of reciprocity is that everything you do to raise the self-esteem of another person causes your own self-esteem to go up. When you do and say things that cause people to like themselves and feel more confident about themselves as people, you like yourself more and you feel more confident about yourself. So, in order to get along terrifically with others, you use the law of indirect effort and focus your attention on the other person. Imagine there's a spotlight on a swivel between you. Whenever you're talking about yourself or thinking about yourself in a conversation, the spotlight is on you. Whenever you are on the spot, you will feel self-conscious and insecure. You will often be unnatural, and in attempting to please the other person, you will usually end up pleasing no one. The solution is to put the spotlight on the other person. Dale Carnegie once wrote that you can make more friends in a few minutes by becoming genuinely interested in other people than you can in a year trying to get other people to be genuinely interested in you. Everyone's self-esteem is lower than it needs to be. Everyone needs to have their self-images validated and reinforced. Everyone needs to feel more valuable and important to others. And if you will consciously and deliberately give people what they want and need, they will reciprocate by giving you friendship and popularity and a welcome wherever you go. The starting point in succeeding with people is to be agreeable. Be an easy person to get along with. Be pleasant and cheerful and positive, rather than argumentative and difficult. Make a habit of nodding and agreeing and going along with what others say, even if it's a little different from what you would say or do. Be relaxed and pleasant and a pleasure to be with. When I was younger, I used to get into arguments with everyone about everything. I was always pointing out the weaknesses in people's positions and identifying the flaws in their arguments, and I was well-researched. However, I found myself spending more and more time alone. People began avoiding me. If I went up to a group at a party or a meeting, the members of the group would see me coming and begin dispersing immediately. No one wanted to get into a verbal battle with me, so they avoided conversation with me altogether. I learned a valuable lesson from that. I learned that the most important thing in life is to be effective in your relationships with others, not to be right. A question that has helped me over the years is the question, what's important here? You'll often find that being right or wrong doesn't really matter. If the other person's position is obviously incorrect, they'll figure it out for themselves in no time at all. But a man convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. You may win the argument, but you can lose the friendship. If you really disagree and you feel that you must say something, protect the self-esteem of the other person by using Benjamin Franklin's method of stating your opinion in a very tentative way. Instead of telling a person that he or she is wrong or misinformed, say something like, "I could be wrong, but I had always thought it was this way." If you show that you're open and willing to change your mind, that you're flexible rather than fixed in your ideas, people will enjoy being around you much more and will enjoy discussing different issues with you. The second key to winning with other people is the practice of acceptance. Each person from early infancy forms their self-image by the way that others react to them. The self-image of your children or your employees is largely determined by the way you treat them.
If you treat people as valuable and important, they see themselves and think about themselves as valuable and important, and they respond warmly and positively to you. In fact, the very first thing that happens when two people meet, especially for the first time, is that a certain level of acceptance is established or not established between them. Much obnoxious behavior is simply a cry for help. It's a cry to be accepted and liked by other people. Psychotherapists are taught to practice what is called unconditional positive regard. This is a way of being calm, positive, and accepting with the patient, no matter what he or she says or what he or she has done. They have found that it's only when a person feels totally accepted by another that he or she can relax and express his or her deepest concerns honestly and be helped back to inner peace. Perhaps the simplest and the most powerful thing you can do to make people feel good about themselves is to smile. Whenever you smile at another person, the other person feels important. He or she feels recognized and admired and accepted unconditionally. Their self-image improves and their self-esteem goes up. They feel good about themselves, and in return, they feel good about you. And all it costs is a simple smile. A fourth way to improve your relationships with others is to practice admiration at every opportunity. Abraham Lincoln once said that everybody likes a compliment. Always be perfectly sincere when you give a compliment, but always compliment things that you like and respect and admire. The best things to admire are the character traits, the possessions, and the accomplishments of other people. We each invest an enormous amount of our emotions in these things, and whenever they're admired or respected by another, our own sense of value and importance grows tremendously. If you admire how hard a person works, or the fact that he or she is always punctual or very accurate and detail-oriented doing their job, not only will people strive to repeat those behaviors, but they will feel wonderful about themselves and about the fact that you noticed it. Remember, the more emotion a person has invested in something, the more powerful and significant will be your compliment when you give it. When you admire specific items of clothing worn by a man or woman, they will often remember your remarks for years. Always be sincere. Never say anything that you don't really mean. People are like human lie detectors. The average individual can sense insincerity from across a crowded room, and if you say something that you don't really believe, it will almost always backfire and have exactly the opposite effect in terms of building a more positive relationship with that person. Always be truthful, and always speak from your heart. In the entire science of self-confidence, nothing is more important than your ability to enter into a long-term, intimate relationship with a member of the opposite sex. Each person is born incomplete and is only truly happy and satisfied when he or she finds the right person and enters into a secure, lasting relationship with that person. Your ability to succeed in your closest personal relationships affects your self-confidence in every other area of your life. Most young people chop and change and experiment widely in their 20s. They go out with a variety of members of the opposite sex as they learn more about what it is they really want in a relationship. At the same time, they change jobs far more frequently, they spend everything they earn and more, and they often move around from place to place. But when you settle down into a permanent relationship, your whole orientation changes. You develop a longer time perspective on your decisions and actions. You become more responsible. You begin to accumulate assets, and you're more thoughtful in handling your money. Most of all, you begin to feel more connected with other people and with your society. You have a greater sense of belonging to your community. You feel more like a part of a greater entity. Your self-esteem and self-confidence go up. The overarching goal of every person is happiness and peace of mind. And your happiness and peace of mind are inextricably interlinked with whether or not you're in a strong, stable relationship and getting along well with that other person. Everything you do that increases your ability to improve the quality of your relationship also increases your self-confidence and self-esteem. A good relationship gives you the strength and courage to take on ever greater challenges and opportunities. Being happily involved with the right person clarifies your vision and causes you to set ever bigger goals for yourself. It gives you a sense of inner security that is expressed in higher levels of optimism and a positive mental attitude toward virtually everything you do. The question naturally arises, if everyone wants a happy and loving relationship, why is it that so few people, by their own admission, manage to achieve it? Why is it that so many people are single, alone, and unhappy, or in marriages and relationships that are empty and unsatisfying? Why is it that people do not have the love they want and need in their lives? And more importantly, what are the specific things that you can do to dramatically enhance the quality of your loving relationships? The law of correspondence says that your outer world is merely a mirror image reflection of your inner world. Your relationships in every part of your life reflect back to you exactly the kind of person you are. Your relationships contain and include all of your thoughts, feelings, attitudes, fears, and desires. Most of what you see in your relationship or marriage is actually a manifestation of what is going on inside of you. Your relationships are a measure of the person you really are. Whenever you're having difficulty in your relationship, you should ask, what is it in me that is causing this other person to behave this way? Or you can ask, what is it in me that is causing this relationship to happen in this way? As you change what is going on inside yourself, you'll see the same changes take place in the people around you. By changing yourself, you change them. By becoming a better person, your relationships get better. By becoming a more patient, loving, and happy person, your relationships become more relaxed, more happy, and more loving. Truly loving people have little difficulty in forming truly loving relationships. The law of attraction simply says that you are a living magnet and that you inevitably attract into your life the people and circumstances in harmony with your dominant thoughts. All the people around you have been attracted to you by the kind of person you are. You can change the people around you by changing the kind of person you are. As you go to work to change yourself by dwelling on the positive qualities that you admire and aspire to, you immediately change the force field of energy around you, and you begin drawing into your life people who are more like your new ideals. The great mistake that most people make is that they attempt to change other people to be more like what they want rather than going to work to change themselves. However, when you think honestly of how hard it is to change even the smallest thing in yourself, you will despair of ever making any significant changes in the behavior or personality of another person. Everything that we've talked about in general on how to get along well with other people applies with equal force to your marriage and to your relationships with members of the opposite sex. For example, if you want to be happy with another person of your choice, become the kind of happy person that he or she would like to be around. Be pleasant and agreeable. Be cheerful and supportive. Make the other person feel important by validating and reinforcing their self-worth. And the easiest way to do this is simply to go along with their innermost beliefs and convictions. Just be agreeable. You can practice acceptance by taking the other person exactly as he or she is, without suggesting that the other person needs to change their appearance or behavior in some way. You can practice appreciation by thanking the other person for every small or large thing that he or she does or says that pleases you. Be sure to admire the positive qualities and attractive possessions of the other person. Be generous in expressing praise and approval for anything and everything that the other person does that's worthwhile. Praise and approval raises a person's self-esteem and causes them to feel more valuable, more worthwhile, and more loving in your presence. Above all, be a good listener. Each person has a deep need to communicate their innermost thoughts and concerns to another person, and they are invariably attracted to the person who will listen to them most openly and honestly. Many men and women have discovered that close attention to what a person is saying is the highest form of flattery. As we said, listening builds trust and intimacy, and is the foundation of excellent communications between two people. And the ability to communicate well is the absolute requirement for happiness between two people. In every study of men and women who have been together happily for many years, they conclude that spending long periods of unbroken time with each other is the glue that holds the relationship together. Each person has a deep need to express himself or herself to another person and to be listened to and heard without judgment or interruption. If we don't get a chance to get all of our talking out of our systems, it bottles up inside of us and we become frustrated. Almost all problems in relationships begin because couples do not keep the lines of communication wide open between them. Perhaps the quality that most assures good communications between two people and which guarantees a long-term, happy relationship is the quality of commitment. Couples who are happy together are totally committed to each other. They look upon the other person as their very best friend. When two people are in the right relationship, they enjoy each other's company so much that there is no one else that they would rather spend time with. When the relationship is right, the two people cannot imagine not being together, and they never even consider or discuss it. They each feel themselves to be half of a whole, incomplete without each other, and totally committed to being together forever. In fact, the decision to absolutely commit yourself without reservation to a relationship is an absolute requirement for happiness in that relationship. And while commitment does not guarantee complete success in a relationship, a lack of commitment will almost certainly guarantee ultimate failure. Charles Murray once wrote, "Until one is committed, there is hesitancy, the chance to draw back, always ineffectiveness. Concerning all acts of initiative and creation, there is an elementary truth, the ignorance of which kills countless ideas and splendid plans. That the moment one definitely commits oneself, then providence moves too. All sorts of things occur to help one that never would have otherwise occurred. A whole stream of events issues from the decision, rising in one's favor all manner of unforeseen incidents and meetings and material assistance which no man could have dreamed would have come his way." You can only communicate and express yourself openly and honestly to another person when you feel deep in your heart that the other person has burned his or her mental bridges and has made a complete commitment to you and to this relationship. If commitment is the key to a happy love relationship, then why is it that so many people have difficulty making this kind of commitment? This brings us right back to the question of self-confidence and self-esteem. You can only like or love another person to the degree to which you like or love yourself. And having the confidence to commit and to enter into loving relationships is determined solely by your own personal level of self-esteem. The more of your personality and your motivations that are clear to you and clear to others, the healthier and happier and less complicated or disturbed you will be. Well, how is this to be achieved? All of psychotherapy and personality development is based on the simple premise of self-disclosure. You understand yourself to the exact degree to which you can explain what you are thinking and feeling to another person, the degree to which you can put it into words. When you feel confident enough in another person that you can relax and tell that person what is going on deep in your mind without fear of rejection or criticism, it is only then that you fully understand that dimension of your personality. It's only then that you are free and happy in that area. In psychotherapy, it's generally accepted that the reason a person is unhappy is because there's something that they're not dealing with. As soon as the person can honestly discuss their problem with at least one other person, they're free of much of the negativity associated with that problem. That part of their personality moves from the hidden or unknown into the known. Meaningful and relevant self-disclosure leads to higher levels of self-awareness. The more of yourself that you can honestly disclose to another person, the more aware you are of yourself. Instead of suppressing or repressing your true thoughts and feelings, you can let them out and see more of who you really are and more of what is possible for you. Greater self-awareness, in turn, leads automatically to greater self-acceptance. The more you know about yourself, the more you accept yourself as a valuable and worthwhile person. The real aim in personality development is for you to reach the point where you accept yourself unconditionally. You accept yourself and think of yourself as being a pretty good person overall. You accept yourself, as Cromwell said, warts and all, and you stop being concerned or preoccupied with your shortcomings. When you accept yourself, you start to like yourself and then to love yourself. Your regard for yourself goes up, and you think of yourself as a valuable and important and worthwhile human being. And with high self-esteem, not only are you ready to move toward peak performance in your activities, but you also become a warm, positive, loving person, and you begin to attract other people similar to yourself into your life. All your relationships improve. You become a more popular personality, and you become more sensitive and more aware of the needs of others. As your self-esteem goes up, you stop being preoccupied with yourself and start finding yourself really enjoying the lives and the company of other people. And the quality of your loving relationships goes up dramatically, like the mercury in a thermometer on a hot day. A truly loving relationship with a person with whom you are completely compatible is exactly what each person needs to complete himself or herself as a human being. This is exactly what you need to achieve and maintain a high level of self-confidence. And each previous session in this program contributes to long-term relationships in some way. For instance, when you establish your values and organize them in order of importance to you, and then make a commitment to live your life consistent with those values, you are going through a process that leads to greater awareness, greater self-acceptance, and higher self-esteem. You are laying down the foundation of true self-confidence. When you set high, challenging goals for yourself, goals that make you stretch toward the outer edge of your abilities, and then commit yourself wholeheartedly toward their achievement, you raise your level of self-esteem and self-confidence, and you keep them high as long as you're working progressively toward achieving something that's important to you. When you commit yourself to lifelong learning, to becoming competent in your field, and then to achieving mastery in your chosen area, you are, by the law of indirect effort, making yourself into a more positive and attractive person. As you take full control of your mind and keep your words and thoughts and mental pictures consistent with the very best person you can be, you activate all the mental laws and create within yourself a tremendous feeling of well-being that generates a steady flow of energy and self-confidence. As you become better and more capable in getting along with a greater number of people, your confidence and your ability to interact effectively in all your human relations goes up, and you become unafraid of new situations involving different people. At every step of this program, as you apply the lessons, you are building yourself brick by brick into the kind of person you really want to be. Now let's talk about some of the differences between men and women and how these differences often lead to misunderstandings and breakdowns in the communication that is so important to our mental health and happiness. First of all, men and women are distinctly different from each other. In the practical material world, they may have similar goals and objectives, but in the personal subjective world, men and women have distinctly different motivations, desires, instincts, and ways of looking at life and relationships. Some of these are obvious, and some of these are not so obvious. In order to survive and thrive with members of the opposite sex, it's very helpful for us to appreciate some basic elements. Men, for example, have a tendency to be more direct, more practical, and more left brain or linear in their thinking. They have more of the hormone testosterone, and as a result, they tend to be more aggressive in their orientation toward life. Men tend to be more competitive and job-oriented, continually comparing their achievements with those of other men. Men tend to identify very strongly with their work and to tie up much of their self-concept in their occupations. The extreme version of this tendency, of course, is called the type A personality. The type A personality is so caught up in his work that he gives very little thought to anything else. He feels like he is on a treadmill or in a rat race. He has what has been called a harrying sense of time urgency. He has more and more to do and less time in which to do it. He seldom, if ever, takes a vacation, and if he does, he takes his work along with him. He is extremely aggressive and hostile to those he feels he's competing with, even with his family if they want more of his time. He has an obsession with his boss and is continually talking about what the boss did and said and what the boss might be thinking. The true type A male, the extreme case, becomes more thing-oriented than people-oriented and begins to take his personal and family relationships for granted. He has what is called the compulsive negative habit pattern, which is rooted in a deep-seated fear of rejection and a feeling of unworthiness that goes back to having experienced conditional love from his father. He strives to get the approval from his work and his boss that he felt he never got unconditionally from his father when he was growing up. The type A's preoccupation with his work becomes a major flashpoint at home because it simply does not seem rational or reasonable to his wife. He often says that he's doing what he's doing for the sake of his wife and children, but they disagree and wish that he worked less and spent more time with them. Men in general are very much into closure or completion. Lack of completion is very stressful for them. They are most interested in discussing situations where there are clear conclusions or resolutions, and their conversations are often oriented toward goals and objectives, toward finishing things and getting things done. Men also have a tendency to be simple and direct and largely uncomplicated in their thinking. They tend to think and talk in terms of facts and conclusions. Any woman listening to this will immediately recognize that her way of thinking is very different from what I've just described. To begin with, women have a richer, more complex, and more interesting inner life. They're aware of far more details and subtleties and nuances than men are. They see more possibilities and ramifications and consequences in a given situation than does the male of the species. If men tend to be direct, women tend to be indirect. Women are more subtle and roundabout in their approach to people and situations. If a woman is having a problem with someone, she thinks of the various ways that the subject could be approached so as to win the cooperation of the other person and to not make waves. A man in the same situation would tend to deal with the problem or person directly. Now, either approach might be successful depending upon the circumstances, but the evidence is that women are more successful than men in dealing with complex interpersonal situations. Women tend to be more emotional, more intuitive, more sensitive, and more aware of how other people are thinking and feeling than men are. Women tend to organize their lives around their relationships, around both their family and their friends. They're much more sensitive to and affected by problems and relationships than men are. Here are some examples that illustrate the differences between men and women in the way they see the world. A husband and wife fly to Orlando and rent a car with the intention of driving south to Miami. They get on the freeway and she's the navigator, looking at the map and the road signs. He's unfamiliar with the roads and suddenly she sees a sign that indicates that they are heading north toward Jacksonville. She asks him, "Honey, is Miami on the road to Jacksonville?" He says, "No, Jacksonville is in the opposite direction." She says, "Well, we just passed the sign saying that we are heading toward Jacksonville." "Never mind," he says, "we're making great time." The tendency of the typical man is to step on the gas and go faster when he finds himself on the wrong road, while the tendency of the woman is to stop and think about where she is and where she wants to go. Another example of the differences between men and women is with regard to shopping. When a man and woman go shopping together, all he wants to do is to get it over with before the walls close in around him. All she wants to do is to use shopping as an opportunity to communicate. When she shows him a blouse and asks his opinion, she is inviting dialogue. Instead, he says, "It looks great. Go ahead and get it." After a couple of hours of shopping, a woman may not have purchased anything. He will probably be tearing his hair out by this time, and she will then suggest that they have coffee or lunch. He is still looking around and seeking some way to achieve closure or completion in this process, and until the shopping trip is over, the typical man will be uncomfortable and feel a little bit like a fish out of water. The difference here is that men are simple and direct and want completion, whereas women are complex and subtle and are quite content to simply enjoy the process. Here's another example showing the difference between men and women. A couple is on a motor trip, and they've been on the road for 2 or 3 hours. As they drive down the highway past a McDonald's, she turns to him and says, "Honey, are you thirsty?" Without looking around, he simply replies, "Nope," and continues driving. After a while, he notices that she is not talking, and when he asks her what's the matter, she replies, "Nothing." In her indirect way, she was saying that she was thirsty and was suggesting that they stop. In his direct way, he was simply replying to her question and continued driving. His mind was on the destination, on completing the trip, and he was completely unaware that she was thirsty and that she wanted to stop. And by the way, when a man asks, "What's the matter?" and a woman replies, "Nothing," it is a very clear sign that something is the matter, and if the man is smart, he will pick up this signal and go to work to find out what it is. Because women are indirect, they tend to be better listeners and more sensitive to relationships than men. According to Cosmopolitan magazine, men are 94% more likely to interrupt a woman who is speaking than a woman is to interrupt a man. When a man interrupts a woman, he is making a big mistake. Not only is he telling her that he doesn't take her seriously, but he is also devaluing and diminishing her as a person. By not respecting her when she is speaking, he is unwittingly attacking her self-respect. And we know that whenever our self-respect or self-esteem is assaulted in any way, we have a tendency to counterattack. We often become angry and defensive and strike back in whatever way we can. This is just another example of the law of reciprocity in action, and it governs almost all relationships. For men, one of the best ways to keep the channels of communication clear is to come home at night and to resist the temptation to tell her everything about his day. Instead, he should ask her about her day. He should ask her what she did and where she went and who she spoke to and what happened as a result. He should encourage her to explain her entire day before he goes on to tell her about his day. This simple exercise of turning the standard tables of conversation will go a long way to enhancing the quality of the relationship. It's amazing how interesting her day has been and how much more enjoyable their relationship will be when they continue to share in this way. And by the way, I've never met a woman who wouldn't gladly throw the television set in the trash can if it meant that TV watching time would now be spent communicating with her and interacting with the family. Here's another common occurrence which shows the difference between the needs and expectations of men and women. The woman tells the man about a problem she is having in her work. He immediately goes into problem solving and a closure mode. He asks her a couple of questions about the situation, and then he says, "Why don't you do this?" or "You should just do that." What he doesn't realize is that when she tells him of her problem, she does not necessarily want him to propose a solution at all. The problem is merely presented as an opportunity to talk. She has presented the problem as a device to trigger a dialogue so that the couple can communicate. If he gives her a quick solution, then she will feel frustrated, and he won't even know what's happened. The very best thing that a man can do in a relationship is to listen and to ask questions like, "Why do you feel that way?" The very best thing that a woman can do is to realize that men deal with things differently from women and to take that into consideration. Remember, the most important thing in the world is love. First, self-love, then love of others, then love of one other person with whom you can establish a deep and lasting relationship. Out of loving and being loved arises a wonderful feeling of self-confidence that gives you the courage to attempt things that you might never have thought possible. Knowing that you are truly loved and that you have earned it and that you deserve it saves you an enormous amount of time and energy and allows you to focus on making your life into a wonderful experience. your willingness and your ability to do everything necessary to enter into a long-term fulfilling relationship with another person is the true measure of how you're doing as a human being. And you can never have more love for yourself than the amount that you can express to another person. Every time you think and act in a loving way, your own self-love and self-confidence goes up. Love is by far the most important thing of all. And if you do the things that other loving people do, you will enjoy the same feelings and the same results. The first skill in successful negotiating, and some people say that this is 90% of success, is preparation. Preparation is the key. The more and better prepared you are prior to a negotiation, the more likely it is that the outcome of the negotiation will be satisfactory. Preparation requires that you do two things. First, get all the information you possibly can about the upcoming negotiation. Second, think the negotiation through carefully from beginning to end and be fully prepared for any eventuality. Begin by finding out everything you possibly can about the situation. If you're thinking of buying a house, take the time to go out and look at 50 to 100 houses and then sit down and compare the various sizes and selections and amenities and costs and sales prices. If you're thinking of buying a car or a stereo set or a product that's available in more than one place, phone all over town to find out how much you can get it for. Always be sure to ask this key question. What's the best deal I can get on this if I buy it today? If you're going to be negotiating with a particular person, find out as much as you possibly can about that person. Speak to other people who have done business with that person and ask for their insights and for their advice on how to negotiate more effectively. Perhaps the most important form of information is your knowledge of alternatives to this negotiation. A basic rule for success and happiness in life is that you are only as free as your well-developed options. If you have only one choice, you are in a very poor position to negotiate in your best interests. But if you have consciously developed a variety of options, not only with this negotiation, but in terms of other solutions to your problems, you're going to get a far better deal for yourself than if there was only one thing that you could do. One of the greatest strengths you can have in any negotiation is to be able to get up and walk away. On the other hand, the more intensely you desire to buy or sell something, and the fewer alternatives you have, the less negotiating power you'll be able to bring to bear in the discussion. Excellent negotiators are able to ride the fine line between wanting to achieve the subject of the negotiation and simultaneously appearing not to really care whether it works out or not. Another form of power in negotiating is timing. You must give careful consideration to exactly when you will sit down to negotiate. For example, in organizations that run on a monthly basis and which have monthly sales targets to meet, you can always negotiate your very best deal in the last few days of the month. In the first few days of the month, there's very little urgency to compromise or make concessions. But as the time to meet monthly quotas gets closer, the people in charge of sales in any organization become more eager to cut corners and make deals. Whenever you possibly can, give careful thought to the timing of any negotiation, and remember, patience almost always tends to work in your favor. And here's an important point. Whenever you present people with something new or with an unexpected alternative, be willing to give them a couple of days to think about it. Encourage them to turn over the new price or terms or conditions in their minds and let them come back to you. If you're patient, people who may be totally opposed to your suggestion when you first bring it up will often come around completely and agree to go along with it if you just give them a little time. And finally, in getting the things you want, remember that no negotiation is ever final. If you find that the situation has changed and that you're no longer satisfied with the terms and conditions of the deal, be willing to go back and reopen the negotiation. Be willing to go back and suggest changes that make the deal more fair and equitable for both parties, and especially yourself. As we said before, and it can't be repeated too often, In all acts of influence, persuasion, and negotiation, the keys to success are to research thoroughly, plan carefully, work systematically, and don't be afraid to ask. Develop the habit of asking for a better deal, for better terms, for better conditions, for better prices, both in buying and selling. Ask for a better job or different responsibilities or for a higher salary or for different benefits. Ask for opportunities. Ask your customers to buy. Ask your suppliers for better prices. Whatever you're offered, always consider it an opening bid, and rather than accepting it the first time, ask for something better. And the more you ask, the better will be your results. And the better your results, the happier and more self-confident you feel, and the more capable you'll be of getting a better deal for yourself in every area of your life. You'll eventually become an expert on getting the things you want, and every time you succeed, you will feel more like the winner that you are meant to be. If you had a happy, supportive, positive, and exciting childhood, and you've grown up feeling wonderful about yourself, unafraid, uninhibited, and full of self-confidence and self-esteem, and what we're talking about here probably won't apply to you. But if you're among the majority, those who have grown up with fears of failure and rejection and feelings of guilt and unworthiness, then you know that these are really the greatest obstacles to the self-confidence that you need to deal effectively with difficult people. We discuss these fears in a little detail because everything in this program is aimed at giving you the specific tools that you need to overcome these fears and inhibitions. With this knowledge, you're just better equipped to build yourself up so that you become unstoppable as a person in everything you do. What we're really talking about here is assertiveness. Assertiveness really means the ability to be your own person and to stand up for yourself in every human interaction, no matter what the situation. Assertiveness is a skill, like typing with a typewriter or riding a bicycle, that you can learn with practice. The good news is that every time you behave assertively, the action itself causes you to feel more effective and your self-esteem and self-confidence goes up. It's almost like a magic button that you can push. But in order to learn something as vital to your success and happiness as assertiveness is not easy. When you attempt to learn anything, you move out of your comfort zone and into your zone of discomfort. Since your natural human tendency is to avoid discomfort of any kind, at any cost, your natural inclination will be to retreat back into your comfort zone. However, to grow, you must consciously resist this tendency and force yourself forward, even though the new behavior feels a little awkward and uncomfortable at first. The fact is that if you're not willing to endure the period of awkwardness that comes before competence and mastery, you never learn and grow and get better at anything. While you're experiencing the awkwardness which comes with saying or doing something that's unfamiliar, you work to relieve your feeling of discomfort by increasing your competence and ability rather than by regressing to your old ways. You resolve to stay the course. You stick with it until the new behavior starts to become comfortable. You begin to feel yourself developing a new level of competence, and eventually the new behavior will be as natural to you as the old one, but with one difference. You will be much more capable of getting the results you desire with the new behavior than you were with the old behavior or way of acting. In talking about assertiveness, it's very helpful for you to select a person that you really like and admire and want to be like. Much of your personality is formed by the people that you consciously and unconsciously look up to. So select a role model, a leader, a man or a woman who is calm and confident and self-assured. Whenever you find yourself in a situation with a difficult person, think about your role model and ask how that person would act in this situation. It's amazing how much this will help you and strengthen you. When I was in sales, for example, I would always think of General Patton with his aggressiveness and his boldness. When I'm dealing with another person, I try to think of Jesus or Albert Schweitzer and how kind and compassionate they might be. Many people create a whole series of role models that they refer to in each area of their day-to-day lives as it becomes necessary. Assertiveness basically means self-esteem. you are assertive to the degree to which you really like and respect yourself and consider your opinions and feelings valuable and worthy of being taken into consideration. The more you like yourself, the more naturally assertive you are, and the more effective you become in dealing with others, even the most difficult of other people. Assertiveness is a purely positive characteristic. There are two other behaviors that are on the opposite sides of assertiveness. You have to be aware of them because we all have a tendency to use them, and you see them demonstrated around you every day. The first of these behaviors is aggressiveness. Assertive behavior is not aggressive behavior. A person who is aggressive tends to be pushy, loud, demanding, overbearing, and obnoxious. A person who is aggressive uses this behavior because it's been successful for him or her in the past. It has become a conditioned response. It's their first line of defense. Whenever they feel themselves in a challenging situation, they switch on to aggressiveness and they begin speaking louder and faster in an attempt to overcome the opposition of the other party and get their way. Aggressiveness is a negative behavior that eventually backfires. It is an attempt to override another person and for someone to get what he wants without concern for what the other person gets. It's basically a form of win-lose negotiation where the aggressive person wins and the other person loses. Aggressiveness, which is closely associated with a superiority complex, is usually rooted in low self-esteem. Often, aggressive people have a very narrow repertoire of behaviors, and if aggressiveness doesn't work, they simply become even more aggressive. And if that doesn't work, they will often do exactly the opposite. They will back off and sulk and refuse to have anything to do with you. At the other end of the spectrum of behaviors is the quality of passiveness. Being passive means letting people run all over you and get what they want, even at the sacrifice of your own best interests. People with deep fears of rejection or feelings of unworthiness often tend to resort to passiveness in any confrontation with other people. They would much rather be unhappy and angry inside rather than speak up and confront another person for any reason. Passiveness is also rooted in low self-esteem. Basically, the passive person does not feel that he or she is of much value, and therefore his or her opinion is not worthy of being considered. In the middle is assertiveness. The assertive person is neither passive nor aggressive. He or she is calm, positive, and firm. The assertive person knows exactly what he or she wants, and at the same time, respects the rights and requirements of others. The assertive person prefers to negotiate and compromise and reach a solution that's acceptable to all parties. The assertive person is quiet and persistent and very clear about his or her goals. And the assertive person is the most successful and effective person in dealing with difficult people. Self-confidence goes hand in hand with winning, with self-esteem, with success and happiness in everything you do. The more self-confidence you have, the more things you'll try, and by the law of averages, the more things you're likely to achieve. The more self-confidence you have, the less you'll be affected by temporary setbacks and disappointments. The more self-confidence you have, the more likely it is that you will have a long, exciting life full of riches, rewards, and self-satisfaction. One of the starting points of self-confidence is for you to recognize that you have tremendous strengths of ability and character that you can bring to bear to accomplish almost anything you want. You are extraordinary. The odds are more than 50 billion to one against there ever being anyone with the unique combination of talents, skills, and abilities that you bring to your life and to your world. And the incredible things that you can do and be, no one knows, not even yourself. But the one thing we do know is that virtually everything noteworthy that you will ever achieve will come from your ability to identify your areas of greatest strength and then to capitalize on them in every situation. Each person has one or more areas of excellence that, if properly exploited, would enable them to be and have and do almost anything they could possibly want. Each person, as the result of years of education and experience, has developed possibilities that make him or her different from all other people. And the men and women who are achieving the most in every field are invariably those who have taken the time to identify their areas of greatest strength and then to capitalize on them continuously. We said earlier that life is the study of attention. Where your attention goes, there will your heart be also. The people, things, and events that hold your attention are indicative of your entire mental makeup. The things you are interested in are an indication of what you should be doing more of. In one longitudinal study examining 1,500 men and women who started out eager and ambitious at the beginning of their careers, they found that only 83 of them, over the course of 20 years, became millionaires. When they went back and studied the attitudes and decisions of these people as they had evolved over the 20 years, they found that every millionaire had one thing in common. Every one of them had chosen a field they enjoyed. They had gone to work in an area of endeavor in which they were extremely interested and which held their entire attention. They had then thrown their whole hearts into becoming very good, developing the strengths necessary to succeed in that area, and then capitalized on those strengths by becoming better and better progressively over time. The conclusion of the study was that success, wealth, and happiness seemed to occur when a person was completely preoccupied doing something else. The wealthy people in this study never set out to make a lot of money. Instead, they set out to find a field that they really enjoyed, and then they devoted themselves to it. The money came as an afterthought. The flip side of this equation is that you will never really be happy or satisfied until you have found a way to apply your unique human capabilities to your life and to your work. I call this the feeling of divine discontent. It's a feeling of uneasiness and dissatisfaction that arises whenever you're not fully challenged by what you're doing. To enjoy high levels of self-confidence and self-esteem, you must be working at the outer edge of your envelope. You must be stretching your capabilities continually. You must have a feeling that you are growing day by day with the challenges that your work is putting on you. Without that feeling of challenge and growth, you'll experience discontent, and this is a good sign. Discontent and dissatisfaction almost always precede a constructive change that puts you onto the fast track and starts you growing once more. We spoke about how important values are to your self-confidence. Men and women with clear values who are living their lives consistent with their highest aspirations are those who have a deep sense of self-confidence and well-being. We also said that the most important value you can have is the value of integrity. Integrity is the value that guarantees all the others. Having integrity means that you will not compromise on what you believe to be right in any area. Integrity is absolutely essential if you want to capitalize on your strengths. It means, more than anything, looking at yourself honestly and making your decisions based on the fact that you are an extraordinary human being. Your feelings are very valuable clues to your choices and behavior. Your peace of mind and personal satisfaction is perhaps the most accurate guide you will ever have to doing what is right for you. In addition to integrity, courage is the most important single quality you can have if you want to be happy and self-confident. If integrity means being honest with yourself, then courage means having the ability to follow where your heart leads you. It means having the ability to push aside all other considerations in order to remain true to the very best that is in you. We said earlier that fear is the greatest single enemy of self-confidence and self-fulfillment. It's not that people don't know what to do, it's usually that they're afraid to do what their hearts tell them to do. But when you build yourself up step by step and gradually overcome the influence of fear, your whole world opens up before you. Your self-confidence rises so high that there are no longer any limitations on what you will attempt or what you will commit yourself to. One of the greatest of all Impressionist painters was a man named Paul Gauguin. He had a family and worked in the post office in Paris for many years. But in the evenings, he visited the cafes frequented by the painters of Paris, getting to know them and asking them questions. He was fascinated by painting. The whole idea of painting absorbed his attention. It was all he thought about, and yet with a family and a full-time job, there was no way that he could devote himself to the painting he wanted so badly to do. One day, after the age of 40, in a move that shocked everybody, he gave up his job as a postal inspector, left his family, and moved to the South Sea island of Tahiti. There, he began painting. His paintings now are worth hundreds of thousands, even millions of dollars, and hang in the finest museums in the world. He is considered by many to be one of the most important painters of the last 300 years. In a way, he was like Grandma Moses in that he finally decided to follow his heart and concentrate on what he had been interested in for all those years. Now, to follow your heart, you don't necessarily need to make dramatic changes in your life or your relationships. What you do need to do is to see yourself honestly as you really are and have the courage to channel your energies and focus your strengths into your areas of greatest potential. And I promise you, when you do this, you will know beyond a shadow of a doubt that you have made one of the best decisions of your life. Each person has great strengths and potentialities, and each person is put in this world to harness those strengths and apply them to benefiting themselves and mankind. The life stories of all the great men and women are simply stories of people who discovered their strengths and utilized them to the fullest degree. Churchill was a great statesman and orator. Florence Nightingale was a tremendous organizer. Florence Chadwick was an incredibly strong swimmer. Abraham Lincoln was a far-sighted and compassionate politician and president. Mother Teresa is a truly loving human being with an infinite capacity to care for and support the sick and dying people of Calcutta. Joe Montana is a quarterback with an incredible throwing arm with the San Francisco 49ers. All around you, you see men and women who have grabbed their major talents, like catching a pass in a football game, and are running for the goalposts. And you can do the same if you have the courage to follow your heart. Before I go on, no discussion of strengths would be complete without a discussion of weaknesses. Strong people have strong weaknesses as well. In fact, people have far more weaknesses than they have strengths. You may be strong in some talents, but weak in hundreds of areas. Weaknesses are an inevitable and unavoidable fact of life. As Peter Drucker said, "All innovations must be simple if they are to work, because there are only incompetent people to carry them out. The one thing that we will always have in abundance is incompetence." Now, Drucker wasn't being unkind. He was being realistic and pointing out that most people are incompetent, just in different areas. The challenge with human weaknesses is that unhappy and unsuccessful people have a tendency to focus on them. They become preoccupied with their weaknesses and think about their inabilities too much of the time. They lose sight of the fact that each person also has strengths that may need to be developed, and that these strengths can and will bring them everything they want. Instead, they dwell continually on their areas of incompetence rather than on their areas of excellence. You may do the same occasionally. You have areas of great potential strength, and you have multiple areas of weakness where you perform in an average or mediocre way. We said earlier that the law of concentration has an inordinate impact on the person you become. Whatever you dwell upon grows. Strong people are those who dwell upon their strengths and abilities. Weak people are those who dwell upon their weaknesses and their inabilities. But to develop and maintain high levels of self-confidence and the success and happiness that goes with it, you must consciously choose to dwell upon your strengths most of the time. One of the best questions you can ask yourself over and over is, what can I and only I do that, if done well, will make an extraordinary difference in my situation? Success comes from staying at a particular thing, the most valuable and important thing you could be doing, until you succeed. Every great human achievement is preceded by extended periods of dedicated, concentrated effort. But there's little to be gained by digging frantically if you're digging in the wrong place. And this brings us to the importance of self-assessment with regard to your strengths and your weaknesses. The critical issue in strategic planning is to increase the return on equity invested in the corporation. It is to allocate and deploy assets in such a way that the rewards that the company earns are greater than they would be in the absence of the planning exercise. We start off with establishing clear values, a clear vision of what the company wants to become in the future, and a written mission statement that describes the strategic objectives and the positioning for the company. Each person needs to do the same for himself or herself. The purpose of your personal strategic planning is to enable you to increase your return on energy. Since your time is your life and your mental energy is your most valuable resource, your job is to organize your efforts in such a way as to give you maximum rewards and satisfaction for energy invested. Each company and each product or service either has or must develop a unique selling proposition. This is the way of differentiating the company and the company's products and services from the competition. Often it's called a competitive advantage. Sometimes we call it an area of superiority. In every case, it is essential to determine how and where and why and in what degree a particular company differs from every other company that is competing with it for the right to create and keep customers. And what applies to companies applies to you. You are the president of your own company. You are the president of your own personal services corporation. You are in business for yourself. No matter who signs your paycheck, you are working for yourself from the day you take your first job to the day you retire. You may go to someone else's office or company, but you are always self-employed. The failure of many people to recognize this and to behave as though this were true is a major reason for low self-confidence, underperformance, unhappiness, and failure in working life. As the president of your own company, selling your services in the marketplace to the highest bidder, you are completely responsible for identifying your own unique selling proposition. What is it that you do better than anyone else? Why are you special or different? What is your area of competitive advantage? If you had to write in 25 words or less exactly why someone should hire and promote and pay you to do a particular job, rather than hire, promote, and pay someone else, what would you point out as your area of superiority? Many people will have a tough time with this question. What matters at this point, though, is that you are asking the question at all. The very fact that you are thinking this way is moving you rapidly into the top 3% of working Americans. Your first question is, what is my unique selling proposition? Your next question is, what will my area of competitive advantage or unique selling proposition be in the future if I make no changes from what I'm doing today? Your next question is, what could my area of competitive advantage be? Of all the areas where you might be able to develop an area of superiority and become really good, taking your values and goals into consideration, what could they be? And the final question, perhaps the most important question on this subject, is the question, what should my area of competitive advantage be? If you could be good at any one thing in the future, whether in 3 months or 3 years, and consistent with your desire to live a great life, what should your area of superiority be? A friend of mine built a company and sold it a couple of years ago. He had money in the bank and he decided to change careers. He had lots of time to think about it and make the right choice. So he went to an industrial psychologist, a friend of his, and took a battery of tests and underwent several interviews to find out what he was ideally suited to do in a new career. At the end of this process, his friend, the industrial psychologist, sat him down and told him that his greatest strengths were consulting and presenting professional development seminars for managers and salespeople. My friend got a little bit angry. He said, "But you know that I'm afraid to speak on my feet in front of a group. You know that it makes me nervous and I become tense even thinking about it." His friend said, "Yes, I know that's true. But you didn't ask me to tell you what would be convenient and easy for you to do. You asked me to tell you what would be the right thing for you to do. And the area where you have the greatest potential strength at this time is in consulting and training managers and salespeople." My friend realized that what he was saying was true. He then went out and took courses where he learned to overcome his fear of public speaking. He learned how to give presentations to a professional audience. It didn't take long, and 6 months later, he began his own consulting and training business. He's now doing extremely well, and he's never been happier in his life. It often happens that your strengths are like muscles, undeveloped and requiring a long period of exercise to build up to the point where you can begin to win competitions. Your starting point is to sit down and set goals for yourself, to decide where you are now and where you want to be in the future. What additional strengths and abilities will do more to enable you to increase your return on energy invested? In what area will a particular strength be useful and valuable to you and enable you to stand out from others? So you begin with the process of self-disclosure. In determining your strengths for the future, you begin to engage in a search process to explore all the different areas where you may have hidden talents. One form of self-disclosure is for you to fill out a series of questionnaires and tests that examine parts of your personality and skills of which you might be unaware. Some years ago, I personally went to an industrial psychologist and took a battery of tests to find out my strengths and weaknesses. And much of my adult life has been affected by what came out of those tests. The tests pointed to areas where I had natural talents and abilities. They also revealed my personality weaknesses and areas where I had little interest or talent. And they can do the same for you. They may save you years of hard work in the wrong job. If you have the time and money, a detailed process of personality and career counseling is a very valuable exercise that can have a major influence on the rest of your career. But if you lack either the time or the money, there are many books full of self-grading tests available in the bookstores. You can take these tests yourself, and they give you very accurate feedback. There are several companies that have developed entire batteries of self-grading assessment instruments, each of which can give you insights into your strengths and weaknesses in particular areas. There are also a series of exercises in self-analysis and self-disclosure that you can engage in yourself with just a pen and paper. These exercises can often open your eyes and help you to see possibilities that may surprise you. Starting in childhood, you have learned how to do and perform a remarkable variety of tasks. You have a tremendous number of skills and talents that you have developed over time, many of which you simply take for granted. Perhaps one of the reasons why so many people have such low self-confidence is because they've never sat down to make up a list of how talented and capable they really are. So, this first exercise for you is to write down a list of everything you do on a regular basis. Write out all your roles and the parts you play from the time you get up in the morning until the time you go to bed at night. If you are a parent, cook, a dishwasher, a driver, a shopper, a reader, a writer, a worker performing various jobs, a buyer, a seller, a negotiator, a teacher, a manager, a salesperson, a typist, a telephone answering person, whatever else you can think of, be as detailed as possible. Walk through your day minute by minute and hour by hour, and write out everything that you do over the course of a day, a month, and a year. When you've completed this list, you will be amazed at how many skills you have developed and which you use on a regular basis. The second part of this self-disclosure and self-analysis exercise is for you to now make a new list where you begin to cluster the various things you do into categories. One of your categories may be a parent. Under the parent heading, write down all the things on your list that you do as a parent that are part of parenting. If you're a manager or a salesperson, or if you hold any other position, write down everything that you do in your job, day in and day out. If you play sports, put sports as a heading, and write down all the physical activities that you engage in. If you're interested in reading, write down all of the subjects you read about on a regular basis. When you've completed clustering all of your roles and activities into groups, the final step in this exercise is to set priorities on each group. Which group of activities is most important to you? Which group of activities is second most important to you? If you're going to be sent to a desert island for an indefinite term and you could only take two or three of these activities with you, which ones would they be? When you've numbered your clusters or groups by priority, you will have created a very clear picture of who you are and what is valuable to you in life. Your next questions might be, What do I need to do in each of these areas in order to get the very most satisfaction and enjoyment from this area? What do I need to do more of and less of? What do I need to get into or get out of? What is more important within each cluster and what is less important? If I had to choose, how would I choose and select among the various things that I do? You'll be amazed at the kind of answers you start to come up with. In my experience, you'll be surprised at the clusters that appear at the top of your list and the clusters, some of which take up an enormous amount of your time, which are not really very important to you at all. But in order for you to really know yourself, you have to take the time to analyze yourself like this on paper. A second exercise which is very helpful in learning more about yourself and which has been a turning point in the lives of many people is to turn to someone close to you and ask him or her what they think you should do with your life. Ask a person you trust what he or she thinks are your strong points and your weak points, your strengths and vulnerabilities. What advice would someone who cares about you give to you about the kind of work you should be doing and the kind of talents you should be developing? Even people who don't know you very well will often be able to give you insights about yourself and your possibilities that will be extremely accurate and may even be in areas you haven't even thought about. I remember driving with a business associate to an appointment that was some ways out of town. We had a chance to talk as we were driving along, and I was sort of wrestling in my mind with what I should do at the next stage of my career. I was seriously considering getting into the business of doing seminars and eventually producing audio cassette programs like this one. On a lark, I turned to him and asked him, in all honesty, if I was going to change careers, what do you think I'd be good at? He sat there and thought for a while as we drove along, and then he turned to me and said, "Brian, I think you'd be very good at speaking and training and doing seminars. You do a lot of reading and research, and you seem to enjoy sharing your ideas with other people. The best use of your time, in my estimation, would be sharing your ideas with audiences." Now, up to that time, I had seldom spoken publicly, and I had never done a seminar before. I won't say that that incident was the turning point for me, but it was the final assurance that I needed to make the decision to become a professional speaker and trainer. This business associate, a casual acquaintance, could see it clearly. Whatever you seem to enjoy the most is a very good indication of where your strengths lie. Your strengths may be completely hidden, but by asking yourself these questions and facing the answers unblinkingly, you will begin to uncover them. And it's when you uncover a potential strength and begin to develop it so that you can use it in your life that you begin to feel really terrific about yourself. Your most important job is to apply yourself where you can make the greatest positive difference. This will be the area where you get your highest return on energy. When you're working and expanding your capabilities in an area of greatest strengths, you feel wonderful about yourself. You feel like a winner. You enjoy wonderful feelings of self-confidence and self-esteem. In addition, it's also very important for your happiness that you develop a proper perspective on the inevitable weaknesses that you will have in almost every area. And here are some thoughts with regard to weaknesses that may be helpful to you. The first thought is that almost every weakness can be viewed as a strength inappropriately applied. If you use one of your strengths where it's neither required nor helpful, it can often be perceived as a weakness. For example, I had a gentleman working for me recently who is extremely aggressive, and he found himself in a management position. As a manager, his aggressiveness made him the kind of person that no one wanted to cooperate with. What I had forgotten was that his major skills lay in selling, in an area of individual achievement. His aggressiveness was a strength in selling, but a weakness when he was put into a management position where his strength could not be used properly. Many of the so-called weaknesses that you might have are merely strengths being used in the wrong place and for the wrong purposes. A weakness may simply be situational. There is an old saying that when you go into the woods, you must expect the mosquitoes. Sometimes you'll be criticized for the things you do, and you may have a tendency to think that you're weak in these areas. But it may be that criticism just comes with the territory. As an example, I speak on sales, management, and motivation to a great number of people, a great number of times, and in a great number of places. People sometimes come up to me and they tell me they didn't like my talk. Now, more than 99% of the letters that I receive are highly favorable, but there are inevitably people who, for some reason, are not happy. These are the inevitable mosquitoes that go along with my profession. And you'll find that there are inevitable complaints and criticisms that go along with whatever you do. They may not be indicative of a weakness at all, merely an opinion or an observation by another person. You may have a personality weakness that has been caused by a previous experience. Someone may have taken advantage of you in the past, and you may be hypersensitive to being taken advantage of again in the future. The slightest suggestion that a person does not completely approve of your behavior might cause you to react negatively. This may be seen as a personality flaw or weakness, while in reality it's merely a result of your previous reinforcement history. It may also be something that will be helpful for you to decide to get over. Your weakness may be amenable to education. Often, the only thing holding you back from extraordinary accomplishment is a little bit of learning. If you take the right courses, listen to the right audio tapes, and read the right books, that may be all that you need to do to become exceptional in your field. And finally, what appears as a weakness may be a key indicator of the type of work or activity that you should not be engaging in. It may be that you don't enjoy that area of endeavor at all. If you try to do something and you consistently do it poorly, this may be a way of your finding out that this is an inappropriate field for you. Take the time to analyze yourself carefully. By practicing disclosure to yourself and others, both in written and spoken form, you'll develop a higher level of self-awareness and self-honesty. As you become more knowledgeable about your strengths, you will become more self-accepting of who you really are. And as your level of self-acceptance goes up and you begin to really respect yourself for your unique talents and abilities, your level of self-esteem and self-confidence will go up as well. When you minimize or downplay your weaknesses and simultaneously identify and maximize your strengths, you will become a peak performer in everything you decide to do.
To realize your full potential for personal and professional growth and development, begin with your values as they apply to your own abilities. As you know, your values are always expressed in your words and actions. You can always tell what your values are by looking at what you do and how you respond to the world around you. Your values are the root causes of your motivations and your behaviors. Now, some values that you might select with regard to your personal growth are excellence, self-actualization, intelligence, skillfulness, achievement, and personal mastery. My primary value in terms of personal development can be summarized in the concept of realizing my full potential. I believe that each person has the potential to do something wonderful with his or her life. I believe that within each person there is a giant waiting to come out. I believe that each person can do vastly more than he or she has ever done before if he or she only learns how. That's my fundamental value. What is yours? Create a long-term vision for yourself in the area of personal growth. Project forward 5 or 10 years and imagine that you were developed fully in every important part of your life. Idealize and see yourself as outstanding in every respect. Refuse to compromise on your personal dreams. What level of skill or ability would you have in your field? What level of status and prestige would you have attained as the result of your superb performance at what you do? What kind of work would you be doing, and at what level would you be doing this work? How would you think and feel about yourself as the result of being one of the very best at what you do? If you had no limitations at all, what would be your vision for how you would develop yourself in the months and years ahead? Now, take your vision and crystallize it into specific goals. Here's a good way to start. Take out a piece of paper and write down 10 goals that you would like to achieve in the area of personal and professional development in the months and years ahead. Write in the present tense,
exactly as if you were already the person you intend to be. Determine exactly what you want to be able to do. Decide the person you want to become. Describe exactly what you will look like when you become truly excellent in your field and your personal life. Then, review this list of 10 goals and select the one goal that, if you achieved it, would have the greatest positive impact on your life and on your career. Put a circle around that goal and move that goal to a clean sheet of paper. Create a schedule for achieving this goal. Set deadlines for achieving certain benchmarks. Set sub-deadlines as well. Make a list of everything that you can think of that you'll have to do to achieve personal excellence in that area. Organize your list into a plan by setting priorities on each of the items. Gather the books, materials, equipment, and other resources you will need to begin working on yourself and your goal. Then, take immediate action on at least one item in your plan to get the process started. Resolve to do something every day until you are successful in that area. Never stop working on yourself until you become the kind of person you would ideally most like to be. Jim Carrey, the actor, when he was just starting out, had a vision and a goal to be paid $10 million for acting in a movie. He made out a check to himself for this amount, and he carried it with him everywhere. He looked at it continually, and he never stopped believing in his ability to earn $10 million for a single picture. Meanwhile, he worked on his craft. He took every role he could possibly get and threw his whole heart into performing that role the very best he possibly could. He developed his ability to speak, to dramatize, and to entertain. He continually stretched his own envelope of performance. He took every lesson that he could take and studied every element of professional acting he could learn from the people around him. After years of hard work, his dream finally came true. He received $10 million for his role in Batman 3. Before he was 40, he was earning $20 million per film. He makes one or two movies each year. He had a clear vision and a dream, and he never lost sight of it. Most importantly, he continued to work on himself and his craft until he was the kind of person who was worth $20 million per picture. The starting point of feeling terrific about yourself is to eat the right foods and to eat for higher energy. Fortunately, there's so much research available to us now on proper diet that we don't have to guess. There have been some exciting scientific breakthroughs over the last few years in nutrition, and if you simply follow them, you'll notice an almost immediate increase in energy. Robert Haas, in his book, Eat to Win, talks about the high-performance diet and the fact that it consists of 75% carbohydrates, about 15% proteins, and only 10% or less of fat. In fact, there's an avalanche of research and proof now that demonstrates that you can eat all you want and still lose weight as long as you eat foods that the body burns off rather than stores. The body burns off carbohydrates of all kinds, while the body tends to store excess proteins and fats around the waist and hips and thighs. The ideal diet for high performance consists of eating lots of fruit, vegetables, and lots of whole grain products. The more colorful the fruits and vegetables, the more vitamins and minerals they contain, and the better they are for you. Fruits and vegetables act as a form of roughage, or nature's roto-rooter, keeping your system clean and light by eliminating toxins and waste products continually. Whole grain products have the same impact and also contain proteins and fats in the limited quantities that you require. Simply shifting your diet away from bacon and eggs to fruit and cereal in the mornings will cause you to be sharper and more alert for the entire first half of the day. Benjamin Franklin, in his autobiography, talks about the fact that at lunchtimes, while his co-workers were stuffing themselves on the free food provided by their employer, he would judiciously chew on a loaf of bread and take a long time to eat very little. He would always satisfy his hunger in this way, and at the same time he would read and prepare for the afternoon. Later in life, when he became one of America's most wealthy and respected men, he said that the starting point of all his success was the habit of eating frugally at lunchtimes. Harvey and Marilyn Diamond wrote a book a few years ago called
Fit for Life. The book became a bestseller on the New York Times book list, and millions of people read it for its unorthodox suggestions about diet. Many nutritionists disagreed with the recommendations in the book, and the subject is still quite controversial. Nonetheless, what the Diamonds simply said was that the greatest consumer of energy in the human body is the process of digestion. If you can make digestion easier by combining your foods in such a way that they do not require so much effort or energy to break down and assimilate, you will have more energy available for other things. Of this conclusion, there can be no doubt. If you eat fruits, vegetables, and whole grains, because they are closer to nature, they will digest faster and you'll feel lighter and more energetic. The Diamonds then went on to say that when you eat proteins, your body secretes acids to break them down. When you eat starches, your body secretes alkalines to break them down. But when you eat proteins and starches together, like meat and potatoes, or eggs and toast, or fish and rice, your body secretes both acids and alkalines, each of which neutralizes the other in your stomach, and your food fails to digest. The digestive process, in effect, is brought to a halt. Your stomach is determined to break the food down before it passes it into the small intestines. When the acids and the alkalines neutralize each other, the body works vigorously to produce even more acids and more alkalines. This draws blood and energy from other parts of the body, making you feel tired and drowsy after eating a large meal. But if you eat proteins and vegetables, or starches and vegetables, rather than proteins and starches together, this digestive problem doesn't occur. You can eat as much as you like, and you will still feel light and clear-headed. You will still get what we might call the Benjamin Franklin effect and be able to perform at your best for hours after eating. The fact is that we eat far too much protein and fat. The body simply does not need as much as we take in to build up new cells. And both proteins and fats are extremely hard to digest. They contain more calories per ounce than any other food. If we take in more than we require, the body simply uses an enormous amount of energy to break it down and then stores the extra protein and fat for use later. In Dr. Robert Jorgensen's work, which has been entitled Eat and Grow Thin, he concludes that the greatest enemy in human health is fat and cholesterol of all kinds. He shows that people can dramatically increase their levels of energy and reduce weight at the same time by simply eliminating fats of all kinds from the diet. Now, while it's true that we do need a small amount of cholesterol for balance, the average person consumes far, far too much fat in the form of butter, margarine, and a variety of oils that are used in the preparation of many foods. One of the reasons that people consume too many fats is because foods containing them seem to have more taste than foods that are cholesterol-free. This question of taste is an ongoing dilemma, but the bottom line is that if you want to, you can train your taste buds so that you really enjoy foods that are also very healthy for you. One of the best of all health habits is the drinking of 6 to 8 large glasses of water each day. Many people start off every morning by drinking 1 or 2 large glasses of water, and then they have a large glass of water handy throughout the day. They largely discontinue coffee and tea and soft drinks and instead satisfy their thirst with water. The evidence is now overwhelming that drinking large quantities of water will have a dramatic and positive effect on your health. Just try it for a day or two and see. There are other things you can do to increase your health and energy. The New York Times had an extensive article a few years ago on one of the greatest breakthroughs linking eating to health, longevity, and long life that's ever been made. They called it Undereating Without Undernourishment. Laboratory rats that had been put on very lean diets lived up to 50% longer than rats that were allowed to eat everything they wanted. The researchers found and continue to find that a person who eats lean and mean, who eats light foods and eats less of them, a person who, in Ben Franklin's words, eats to live rather than living to eat, will be much fitter, healthier, and will have more energy. He or she will need less sleep and have a greater sex drive. More than anything else, eating lean and eating products containing high levels of nutrients at the same time reduces the incidence of diseases of all kinds. And if the experiments with the rats are any indication, it may be the key to increasing the average human lifespan from 75 years up to 100 years or more. When anthropologists examine the lifestyles and eating habits of men and women from tribes throughout the world where it's common to live to the age of 110 years and more, they find that whether in Peru, the Soviet Union, or among the Hunza tribe of northern India, these peoples have three things in common. The first is, as you can imagine, they eat lots of fruits, vegetables, whole grain products, and lean source protein. The second factor they have in common is that they live in mountainous areas and engage in a lot of what we call today aerobic exercise. The third thing they have in common is that in their cultures, older people are highly respected, and they remain deeply involved in the goings-on of their communities. They feel valuable and worthwhile, and their attitudes toward themselves and toward their communities are very positive. One final point with regard to nutrition and its association with health, happiness, self-confidence, and long life is the importance of regular elimination. Now, a diet rich in fruits, vegetables, and whole grains not only gives you a wide range of nutrients, it also assures you a smoothly functioning digestive system. True self-confidence comes from positive knowing rather than positive thinking. Your job is to develop the kind of unshakable self-confidence that makes you an unstoppable force of nature. Your job is to take every step possible to make yourself so positive that you become irresistible and able to accomplish any goal that you set your mind to. And one of the most important things you need is an absolute faith in your ability to overcome any adversity that the world can throw at you. Napoleon Hill said that persistence is to the character of man as carbon is to steel. He also said, before success comes in any man's life, he is sure to meet with much temporary defeat and perhaps some failure. When defeat overtakes a man, the easiest and most logical thing to do is to quit. That is exactly what the majority of men do. In reality, your persistence is your measure of your belief in yourself and your ability to succeed. If you absolutely believe, without question, that if you persevere long enough and hard enough, you will ultimately win through, then nothing will stop you. And when you build within yourself this absolute assurance, then virtually anything becomes possible for you. Robert Ringer, in his best-selling book, Million Dollar Habits, says that the most important of all the habits that lead to great achievement is what he calls the reality habit. I choose to call this the reality principle, and it's consistent with the experiences of men and women who have achieved greatness in almost every field. Happy, successful people are intensely realistic. They do not allow themselves the luxury of self-delusion. They face the world as it is rather than the way they wish it would be. They accept the unalterable facts of life as given, and they work and plan their activities around them. It's easy to feel good about yourself and to have high levels of self-confidence when everything is going well. But the true test of a man or a woman is when you can keep your head and continue to function when things seem to be falling down all around you and everyone else is discouraged and often blaming it on you. These are the times when you really show the kind of stuff you are made of. The business school at Stanford University has done extensive research into the qualities of a man or woman that mark him or her for advancement into the executive suite and ultimately to the position of a president and chief executive officer. After examining dozens of qualities, they were finally able to identify two qualities that were most representative of the superior person in terms of assuring that the organization under their control would continue to survive and thrive in a dynamic and competitive world. The first quality was the ability to perform as a member of a team and the ability to put together teams to accomplish common objectives. But the second quality was harder to measure, even though it was also absolutely indispensable for long-term, high-level success. This quality was the ability to function well in a crisis. Napoleon called this 4 o'clock in the morning courage, the kind of courage that is instantly available to a person woken up at that time who has no time to prepare mentally and emotionally for a crisis. He called this the rarest form of courage, and in his conclusion, very few people had it. In military terms, they call this being under fire. A question that all soldiers, sailors, and airmen wonder about is how they and others will perform under fire. They know that this is the ultimate test of character and training of an individual. Your self-esteem and self-confidence is closely tied to your deep inner feeling about your ability to be effective when faced with problems and difficulties that hit you like a punch in the solar plexus. It's your ability to pick yourself up from the mat and keep on swinging that is the real measure of what you're made of. One of my favorite poems is by Robert W. Service, and it's called The Quitter. There's a verse in that poem that goes like this. You're sick of the game. Well, that's a shame. You're young, and you're strong, and you're bright. You've had a raw deal. I know. But don't squeal. Buck up. Do your damnedest and fight. It's the plugging away that will win you the day, so don't be a piker, old pard. Just draw on your grit. It's easy to quit. It's the keeping your chin up that's hard. The quality of your entire personality is affected by how you deal with adversity and how well you keep your chin up. Successful and self-confident people are not those who don't have problems. They're merely those who deal with their problems in a different way from the average. B.C. Forbes, the founder of Forbes magazine, wrote that history has demonstrated that the most notable winners usually encounter heartbreaking obstacles before they triumphed. They won because they refused to become discouraged by their defeats. And so can you. No matter how well our parents protect us while we're growing up, sooner or later we face challenges and difficulties in our relationships, our work, and our other activities. Each time we face one of these external challenges, we have the choice of either responding positively and constructively or of letting it overwhelm us. If we choose deliberately to respond in a positive and constructive way, to keep our minds calm and cool and deal effectively with the inevitable problem, we learn and grow and become stronger. Our self-confidence goes up. Our belief in our ability to achieve our goals increases. Our self-esteem rises. We form a better self-image and we become more self-assured and optimistic. Every large company goes through the same cycle of challenge and response. If a small company is capable of rising to the inevitable setbacks and reversals it experiences, it continues to grow and triggers even greater responses. Peter Drucker once said that a company stays in business as long as it continues to make enough money to pay for its mistakes. One business consultant estimated that every 3 months a small business has a crisis that, if not responded to properly, can lead to the collapse of the enterprise. You and I are similar to small businesses in many respects. Fortunately, an inability to respond will not lead to something as final as a business collapse, but if for any reason we don't get on top of the challenges, but rather let them get on top of us, our self-esteem and self-confidence will go down, and our ability to deal with subsequent difficulties will diminish dramatically. As I mentioned before, almost everything that happens to you is determined by your response to life. In your responses are contained everything you have learned and everything that you have become. Thomas Huxley said, "Experience is not what happens to a man, it is what a man does with what happens to him." Your life and everything about you is demonstrated in the way you react. It's not in what happens to you. This is why the Stanford study was quite clear when it stated that the proven ability to function in a crisis is the absolute prerequisite for promotion to a senior position. In a way, what we're really talking about here is character. One of the aims of your life should be to develop your character, to become a better and finer and stronger human being. But the development of character, although essential to your long-term happiness and well-being, is not as easy as it seems at first. You probably make every effort to organize your life in such a way that you minimize or remove the unexpected and usually unpleasant surprises that may occur. You use your intelligence, your education, and your experience to arrange your life and affairs so that you avoid adversity wherever and whenever possible. You probably plan and prepare exhaustively in advance to assure that things go smoothly both at home and at work. You are especially careful with your health and with the well-being of members of your family. Almost everyone does this, except for those who are thoughtless and irresponsible. Yet in spite of making every effort to avoid adversity, you experience adversity nonetheless. Adversity comes to you unbidden. You tend to be blindsided with adversity, and it befalls you in spite of your very best efforts to the contrary. But yet, in the absence of adversity, you cannot go and develop your character. You cannot become a better person. You cannot develop resilience, perseverance, and resoluteness of character. You cannot develop into the kind of person who enjoys high levels of self-confidence and a feeling that you can meet and master whatever you're faced with. You cannot grow stronger without adversity, which you consciously and deliberately avoid. You cannot develop the character which is the mark of the mature person. Caught in this conundrum, you have only one choice. You can choose in advance to be equal to the occasion. Ann Landers summed it up beautifully in these words. She said, "If I were asked to give what I consider the single most useful bit of advice for all humanity, it would be this. Expect trouble as an inevitable part of life, and when it comes, hold your head high, look it squarely in the eye, and say, 'I will be bigger than you. You cannot defeat me.'" Frederick Robertson said, "It is not the situation that makes the man, but the man who makes the situation. It is not what happens to you, but how you respond to what happens to you that determines your whole life." In his whole question of responses is contained all the elements of human greatness or depravity. Great men and women are simply those who have responded well when the chips were down, and the rest is history. Dr. Abraham Zelsnick of Harvard is one of the few people who has ever done extensive research into the subject of disappointment. What he found in studying the way that different people respond to disappointment was that you could largely tell how high and how far a person was going to go in life by simply analyzing how they reacted when they faced frustration and setbacks in reaching their goals. Dr. Zelsnick found that the great majority of people do not prepare mentally for the inevitable disappointments that come in life, and when they arrive, they tend to be taken off guard and emotionally overwhelmed. They generalize the disappointments and allow themselves to feel that because they have not succeeded, they are not really very good at what they do. They tend to see these disappointments as being indicative of their inabilities and lack of confidence. They become easily disappointed in themselves, and they lose the courage and confidence that they need to press forward. Often, they become depressed, and in the majority of cases, they gradually give up. They stop setting goals and working on themselves and become more concerned about security and potential loss than about taking chances and potential gain. The winners in his study responded to disappointment very differently. First, they mentally prepared for a disappointment in advance so that when it arrived, they had already given some thought to how they would react and to the possible courses of action open to them. They looked upon a particular setback as very specific and not being indicative of a general lack of ability or of a character flaw. More than anything else, these superior men and women had developed a series of mental tools that they used almost automatically whenever things went wrong for them. Napoleon Bonaparte is considered by historians to have been perhaps the most brilliant battlefield general in human history. In a military career spanning 25 years and involving hundreds of battles, large and small, he lost only three. Napoleon was famous for having taken the time to think through every possibility of the upcoming battle with no illusions and with an attitude that dealt with the worst possibilities and reverses that could occur. When the battle was underway and confusion reigned everywhere, a steady stream of messengers and officers would come to him with news, requesting instructions on what to do next. His responses were always clear, concise, and immediate. No matter what happened, he had an order and an answer at the tip of his tongue. And the reason for this, and what helped to make him the master of all of Europe, was because he had thought everything through in advance. This program on the science of self-confidence is meant to be very practical and helpful to you. In the next few minutes, I'm going to share with you some of the mental tools used by the most effective men and women in our society to cope with adversity. What I suggest you do is that you turn them over in your mind and review them regularly until they become an automatic part of your thought processes. And when they do, I promise you that you will have taken a giant step toward becoming unstoppable and toward enjoying the high levels of self-confidence that are possible for you. The first mental tool is to reassess your entire attitude toward the concept of failure. You know that the fear of failure is the greatest single obstacle to success and happiness in adult life. It's been learned, and as a result, it can be unlearned, thereby freeing you from the fears that hold you back and giving you the self-confidence that propels you forward. The starting point of eliminating this fear is for you to accept and realize that no success is possible without failure. All success is preceded by failure, usually great failure continued over a long period of time. Abraham Lincoln was considered one of the great failures of American politics, a man who had lost his business, lost his sweetheart, and was defeated for election over and over again. However, by learning from every temporary defeat, he won the final election and became one of the most important and respected presidents we've ever had. As Stanley Judd wrote, "Don't be afraid to fail. Don't waste energy trying to cover up failure. Learn from your failures and go on to the next challenge. It's okay to fail. If you're not failing, you're not growing." You only learn how to succeed by failing, and no success is possible without it. Thomas J. Watson was once visited by a young journalist who asked him how he could be more successful faster. Watson, the founder of IBM, replied with these wonderful words. He said, "Do you want to be successful? Then double your failure rate. Success lies on the far side of failure. Every man or woman of great achievement has been, at one time, a magnificent failure. The greatest successes of our generation and of our history books are merely stories of men and women who have failed often enough so that they finally learned how to succeed." On the David Susskind show some years ago, they had four men who had all become entrepreneurial millionaires before the age of 35. They asked them during a break to add up and calculate the total number of different businesses that they had started or tried before they found the business where they made their fortunes. It turned out that the four men had started an average of 17 businesses each, an average of 16 of which had been unsuccessful. But it was the 17th business on average that had made them rich. Now, the obvious question is this. Did those young men fail in each of their previous business enterprises? And the answer is clear. They were not failing. They were merely learning how to succeed. Their previous business enterprises were the testing grounds where they learned the lessons necessary to achieve the financial independence, which was their real goal. Thomas Edison was the most successful inventor of the 20th century, or of any century. But Thomas Edison was also an extraordinary failure as an inventor. He failed more times than any other inventor of his age. He failed thousands and thousands of times in attempting to find the proper filament for the first electric light bulb. He failed thousands of times more in attempting to find the proper plant from which to draw natural rubber. And in his laboratories at what is now known as General Electric, he brought together some of the finest scientific minds of the age so that they could dramatically increase the number of their failures. You see, Edison knew that success is a numbers game. It's based on intelligent effort and the law of averages. If you try enough different things in enough different ways and you learn from each trial, then you must inevitably be successful. The fear of failure, on the other hand, causes people to try fewer and fewer things, thereby lowering the likelihood that they will ever achieve anything of consequence. In the same year that Babe Ruth hit more home runs than any other batter in America, he also struck out more than any other batter. When the ball was thrown, he swung with every ounce of strength he had, often spinning around and falling down on the ground as a result of his efforts. But he also set an American baseball record that was not broken for decades, and he became a legend in his own time. Your job is not to fear failure or to so fastidiously avoid failure that you also avoid success. Your job is to move forward and take intelligent risks, thinking them through in advance and learning from everyone in retrospect. Zig Ziglar says that you can tell how high a building is going to go by how deep they build the foundation. The height to which you rise in life will always be determined by the depth of your own personal foundation, which is almost always the quality and quantity of your failures and what you have become as a result of them. Napoleon Hill wrote, "When defeat comes, accept it as a signal that your plans are not sound. Rebuild those plans and set sail once more towards your coveted goal." And Dale Carnegie wrote, "The successful man will profit from his mistakes and try again in a different way." The starting point of triumphing over adversity is to overcome the fear of failure to the point where you are willing to proceed boldly in the direction of your dreams. We said before that whatever your emotions, they control your decisions and everything you do. When you write down clear goals and make detailed plans for their accomplishment and think about your goals all the time, you build within yourself the white-hot heat of desire, which can eventually become so powerful that it overcomes any fear of failure that might hold you back. The more you think about your goals and talk about your goals and write out your goals on paper, the more determined you become to make them a reality, and the more likely it is that you will push yourself forward to overcome the petty fears that might hold you back. The third mental tool that you can use to triumph over adversity and to keep your self-confidence high is to know how to deal with an unexpected disappointment, one step at a time. Let me explain. Whenever one of your cherished dreams blows up in your face or you hit a stone wall in the pursuit of one of your goals, there's a natural reaction process that you and everyone else goes through. When you can recognize this process in yourself, you will be better able to see it in others and better able to deal with it. Elizabeth Kubler Ross refers to this process as the five stages of dealing with death. They are the same for dealing with the death of a dream, or a hope, or a goal, or even the death of your peace of mind from an unexpected source. The five stages seem to be identical. The first stage, when something goes completely wrong and you are confronted with an unexpected setback, similar to the death of a friend or relative, is denial. You simply refuse to face it. When a company is in trouble or a person's career is not going well, this is the most common reaction. In this first stage, you refuse to accept what has happened as a reality. You say something like, "I can't believe it," or you say, "That can't possibly have happened." You demand proof, and you immediately want to phone somebody or get information to verify what you've been told. The second stage, once you confirm that what has happened is an actual fact, is anger. Anger is triggered by a feeling of pain or fear, especially of uncertainty or of the unknown. The fact of losing a big customer and what that might mean to your bottom line immediately triggers anger and a tendency to lash out. You'll become angry at yourself and angry at the customer, angry at your competitor. This is why very often people blow up when they hear bad news. The third stage of dealing with a disappointment of any kind is blaming. As a result of childhood conditioning, it's almost an automatic response for us to look around for someone to blame when something goes wrong. We want to be able to point the finger at the person whose actions caused this setback. If we ourselves cause the problem, we'll blame our secretary, our friends, our family, we'll even shout at our children. But in any case, someone gets the blame. The fourth stage is usually depression. Especially in the case of a death, but also in the case of any major loss, you have a tendency to feel depressed and a little hopeless. You feel like a victim. Your level of self-confidence plummets, and you feel, "What's the use?" If you're not careful, you will take a single setback or disappointment and generalize it to yourself as a person. You will feel that this setback signifies a major flaw in your personality or in your ability. The fifth stage of disappointment is when the lights begin to come back on. This is when you accept full responsibility for what has happened. At the very least, you accept responsibility for your responses, for the way you react to the situation. You begin to exert a certain amount of self-control and self-mastery. you accept the disappointment as a fact and decide that there's no use crying over spilt milk. You say to yourself something like, well, what cannot be cured must be endured. Once you've accepted responsibility and turned your eyes upward toward the future, toward what can be done rather than toward what has happened, you move to the final stage, and that is the stage of action. You consciously choose the future over the past. You become solution-oriented rather than problem-oriented. You begin to look for the valuable lesson you can learn from this situation. You begin to think how you can minimize the damages and maximize any opportunities that might arise out of this setback. Friedrich Nietzsche, the philosopher, is famous for having said, "What doesn't kill me makes me stronger." You know that the only antidote to negativity and worry and low self-esteem is positive, purposeful, constructive action in the direction of your goals. As soon as you get busy, your self-esteem and your self-confidence start to go up again. You start to feel more in control of your emotions and of your life. You stop making excuses and you start making progress. You start thinking about how you can turn this situation to your advantage. And the most important thing you can do in dealing with any setback is to deliberately move through the five stages as quickly as possible. In the final analysis, you triumph over adversity by having clear values, clear goals and plans, and complete control over your mind and your thinking. You win by resolving to persist, no matter what the odds, no matter what happens, until you succeed. You recognize that persistence is a form of courage. It is the courage to endure in the face of adversity and disappointment, and it is the quality which guarantees that ultimately you will be successful. Calvin Coolidge, President of the United States, summed this up when he wrote, "Nothing in the world can take the place of persistence. Talent will not. Nothing is more common than unsuccessful men with talent. Genius will not. Unrewarded genius is almost a proverb. Education will not. The world is full of educated derelicts. Persistence and determination alone are omnipotent." Persistence is self-discipline in action. Each time you exert the self-discipline to persist in the face of adversity and disappointment, your self-esteem goes up. By engaging in the action of persistence, you build up your resistance to taking the easy way out. You create the friction that comes from going against your natural tendencies. You generate the heat that crystallizes your character at a new, higher level. And with this higher level of persistence, self-discipline, and character, your self-esteem, self-respect, and personal pride go up. Your belief in yourself serves as a deep foundation of confidence upon which you build a great life. You become more positive, more optimistic, and more unstoppable in everything you do. And you do this because, as Churchill said, you never give up. Never, never give up. By every measure, you have more talent and ability than you can ever use in an entire lifetime. You too can step on the accelerator of your own potential and begin moving forward at a speed that will amaze you. So here's the question. How do you infuse your whole life with the kind of self-confidence that makes everything possible for you? Well, here are what I call the four D's, which underline success in anything you want to accomplish. The first D is desire. You must really want to become a totally self-confident human being. Your desire must become so intense that it overrides your fears of failure and rejection and inferiority, and it becomes the dominant emotion governing your behaviors. The second D is decision. You must make a do-or-die decision that you will go to work on yourself and keep at it until you achieve the kind of self-confidence that enables you to do and be and say whatever you want. The third D is determination. Once you have started to make significant changes in the way you act, your internal gyroscope will try to take over and bring you back into your comfort zone, into your old ways of acting. Sometimes progress will be slow, and often you'll see no progress at all. Nonetheless, you must persist in the positive and constructive behaviors that you know will lead to making you into the kind of person you wish to become. Your determination must be as unshakable as the self-confidence that you desire. The fourth D is discipline. Underlying and surrounding all great achievement in life is the quality of self-discipline. This is the ability to make yourself do what you should do, when you should do it, whether you feel like it or not. If you have the desire to change and the decisiveness to take action, the determination to persist on your forward track, and the discipline to make yourself do whatever you need to do, your self-confidence and your success are inevitable. We said earlier that self-confidence comes from positive knowing rather than from just positive thinking or hoping. It's only when you have a firm conviction or belief in your abilities based on experience that you really know that your self-confidence is not an act. This is why every act of self-confidence builds your self-confidence. Every success you experience builds your self-confidence and your ability to achieve further successes. Every mental exercise that you engage in to improve and strengthen your personality builds your self-confidence. And everything that you learn and practice from the lives of other self-confident people improves your own self-image, increases your own self-esteem, and raises your own self-confidence. I spoke earlier about the importance of selecting your values and organizing your entire life around what you believe to be right and good and true. As long as you know that you are living consistent with your highest principles, your self-confidence rests on an unshakable foundation. I've talked throughout about the importance of setting clear goals and deciding exactly what you want in every area of your life. You know that big, important, challenging goals, clearly defined, improve your overall self-concept and build your self-confidence. When you plan your work and work your plan and dedicate your energies to completing high-value tasks, you see yourself making rapid progress toward the attainment of your goals, and your self-confidence goes up. Every time you resolve to go the extra mile, to do more than you're paid for, to put in more than you take out, and to go beyond what is expected of you in your job and in your relationships with others, you feel terrific about yourself. Your level of self-confidence increases, and you feel motivated to contribute even more of yourself to what you're doing. When you dedicate yourself to becoming better and better at performing the important tasks in your life, you feel an enhanced sense of mastery and competence. Your belief in yourself deepens, and your ability to get the results that are important to you increases. Your ongoing commitment to personal and professional development gives you a feeling of continuous growth. Whenever you feel yourself growing as a person, you feel internally motivated and energized to achieve even more. And the more you learn, the more you can learn. The more you develop yourself, the more capable you become of further development. As you see and feel your life getting better, you feel more positive and more in control of your own destiny. You like and respect yourself more, and your self-confidence increases. Any positive, constructive, and self-determined action that you take in the direction of your dreams improves your self-image and raises your self-confidence. When you keep your thoughts and your actions consistent with your highest aspirations and your most valued goals, you are progressively building the unshakable kind of self-confidence that enables you to accomplish almost anything. Talk to yourself positively all the time. Say to yourself, "I can do it. I can do it." Or say, "I feel healthy. I feel happy. I feel terrific." Create a positive, suggestive environment around yourself. Create clear mental pictures of the person you want to be and the things you want to do. Read books that expand your mind and increase your abilities. Listen to educational audio cassettes in your car. Get around positive people and get away from negative ones. Prior to every event of importance, mentally rehearse and see yourself performing at your very best in the upcoming situation. Recall and relive a previous excellent performance. Before falling asleep, think about the things you did right during the day and the things you're going to do better in the days to come. soak your mind in positive images of you at your personal best. Whenever something happens that throws you off balance, stabilize yourself by thinking about your goals. Because of the law of substitution, you can only think one thought at a time, and if you think about your goals, your mind will instantly become positive again. Whenever you have the choice of doing what is fun and easy rather than what is hard but necessary, force yourself out of your comfort zone in the direction of your dreams. Consciously resist the temptation to go easy on yourself. Remember that the comfort zone is the great enemy of human performance and human potential. It is only in the area of challenge and risk, where you force yourself just beyond what is comfortable and easy for you, that the possibilities of success await. Each act of courage and boldness on your part not only builds additional courage and boldness, but it also builds your self-confidence. The more often you dare to go forward, even in the face of uncertainty, the more likely it is that this type of courageous behavior will become a habit for you. You will gradually act yourself into feeling unafraid in almost all situations. There will be nothing that you won't risk or try. You will develop such confidence in yourself that you absolutely believe in your ability to succeed, even against difficult odds. And because success is based on the law of averages, you will ultimately succeed, and succeed greatly. Be sure to take good care of yourself physically every hour and every day. If you're not happy with your physical appearance, go to work to improve it. Set a series of goals to be at your perfect weight and to wear the ideal clothes for you and to be perfectly groomed in every respect. Your self-confidence is strongly affected by your self-image. Your self-image, on the other hand, is largely determined by the way you think that other people see you. When you work hard on yourself and take the time to produce an image that you know is attractive to other people, you feel wonderful about yourself and your self-confidence goes straight up. The final key to self-confidence was put forth by Dorothea Brand in 1935 when she said, "The high road to success is to act as if it were impossible to fail, and it shall be." The real difference between the winners and losers in life is the difference between acting and non-acting. It's between the people who do and the people who talk about doing. It's between the movers and shakers and those who just watch the world go by. Perhaps your greatest responsibility to yourself is to become a person of action, to act yourself into feeling the emotions that are consistent with high performance. Your primary job is to make any effort, overcome any obstacle, and scale any height to become the dynamic, unstoppable, irresistibly self-confident person that you are capable of becoming. And when you have developed in yourself this fundamentally important quality of self-confidence, everything else will be possible for you.